The original program indicated that we would meet in Good Hope Chambers today, and a lot of members didn't hear or weren't listening when Mr. Romano announced that we are meeting in this venue, hence the confusion. We do apologize for that. Honorable members, we have with us today, we're honored to have him here with us. We normally have him here, Mr. Dion Radman, but we understand that one of these fine days he'll be taking leave of the Department of Justice. What? Now, Mr. Radman has been an old friend of this committee, and so he's requested an opportunity to say a few words to you. And I have agreed. No. Mr. Radman.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I was informed by Lawrence that this might be the last meeting of the committee this year. It might not be. But I had to be in Cape Town for other meetings, and I thought that this would perhaps be an opportune moment to inform you that I have indicated to the DG my intention to retire at the end of this year, in other words, the end of December. I must immediately say that probably was and still is the most difficult decision of my life. I thought about it about 2 years ago, and then I'm very happy that I stayed on for those 2 years. But I had to make the decision at one or other stage. I've been a public servant for 46 years. I think that is a very long time, and I think it is really time for me now to take leave. And when I do so, Chair, I would like to thank you for all the friendship that you've shown towards me, and also I would like to thank the predecessors that served as chairpersons of this committee, and I start off with Johnny De Lange, then Deputy Minister Fatima, Deputy Minister Karim, Deputy Minister Ramaflori, and now of course yourself. And Chair, you will recall that we met each other in the early 90s, and I remember one of the conversations that we had, and that was at an airport somewhere. We talked about rugby, and we talked about the Springbok emblem, and I asked you to use your influence to see that emblem remains, and you kept your word. We still have that emblem. Therefore, thank you to all the chairs. And of course all the members as well over the many, many, many years. I've worked under so many ministers as well since 1994, starting off with Minister Dala Omar, Daniel Maduna, Bridget Mpandla, Deputy Minister Suti, who was then Minister of Justice, and now Minister Jeff Hadebe. And I must say, I enjoyed every moment of that. I enjoyed the opportunity to serve the committee since 1994, and even prior to 1994, when we had the tricameral parliament, where I also had to serve the committees. I've been involved with legislation for close on 25 years. So, Chair, thanks very much for that. If I must just talk about one or two highlights of my career, which I perhaps should not do, but I felt that I would like to do so. And it was during the early 90s when I became involved in the drafting and signing of the National Peace Accord. Some of you might remember that, some of you might have forgotten about it, some of you might never have heard about it. It was a fantastic time. I was appointed as the executive director of the National Peace Secretariat, and also overseeing the administrative work of the Goldstone Commission that you will also remember. Those were really exciting times, difficult times, but exciting times. And then lastly, when I was appointed as the executive director of the Transitional Executive Council that was established before the elections, we started operating in late 93, and I was appointed as the executive director, of course, by all the parties that were involved in that process. I remember the first meeting that I had. Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa was then heading the ANC component of that structure, and I remember the first meeting that we had here in the Goedehoop Centre. We had a stand-up fight, Mr. Ramaphosa and myself, and afterwards he came to me and he said, "You must remember, we put you here and we can remove you." But I eventually stayed until the end of the term of the Transitional Executive Council, and then from there went to constitutional development for a few years, and thereafter returned to justice again. So Chair, really I would like to thank you. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. Thanks for the opportunity to address you. You asked me this morning, what am I going to do? I'm not sure yet, but I am going to do something. I'm not going to sit at home. And I must say, I am looking forward to a break and exploring new options. And I must still find out exactly what it is that I want to do. So thanks very much for the opportunity. Thanks once again for working with all of you. I enjoyed every moment. Thank you very much.
Mr. Redman, yes, we've come a long way. I'm not sure that I should take credit for the Springbok emblem. I think the credit for that lies with Nelson Mandela and the late Steve Tshwete. Both gentlemen, pretty early in our history, took a decision that it should remain. Maybe I should also inform members of a little anecdote of my own way back in early 90s when the Honorable Johnny De Lange was chair of this committee. Ministry of Justice had, I still believe it does, the best drafting division, legislation drafting division in the country. And very early we realized that they were a group of brilliant men. Now, you must recall at the time that it was all about affirmative action and quickly changing the face of most government structures. And there you had this division, all white, all male, very pale, and I think all Afrikaner. And informally we raised this with Johnny De Lange, and we said to him, "You better tell the minister that if he changes those guys, he's going to have very, very serious problems with the rest of us." Well, we took that message to the minister, and surprise, surprise, he agreed with us. In fact, he was worried that we would come to him and say, you'd better change that team. There's too many male, white, pale faces in it. The bulk of that team, well, some of them, most of them are still there, Mr. Rudman. Some may have left. Some may have passed on. And it's due to people like yourself that the Ministry of Justice and the Department of Justice still produces the best pieces of legislation to be tabled in this Parliament. We acknowledge that other departments don't deal with legislation so much, and so there's no need for them to have drafters of the caliber of yourself, Mr. Bassett and others. But I can tell you this, that members of Parliament who serve on other committees and have to deal with legislation really, really suffer with the quality of legislation they have to deal with. And I did say to you at one point, just off the cuff, can't you guys arrange some kind of workshops for drafters in other departments? And I know you mentioned something about doing that, and possibility of Justice College doing likewise, but I'm not sure that it's going to get very far. And of course, now you're leaving us, so that's probably the end of that. But I just want to reaffirm, and I know that my predecessors, all of them, will agree with me when I say that you've been an outstanding servant of this country. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I mean, I completely, all 46 years I've been here on this committee for the entire one, so I can't unfortunately share any anecdotes about you other than what I've seen over the last year, but it certainly has been a pleasure working with you. Your expertise has been obvious from what we've, from our dealings with you. I think you might have just found yourself a new retirement job, perhaps start a consultancy firm for state law advisor drafters. Just on behalf of the DA, I would like to wish you a very happy retirement, and also echo the huge thank yous for your service to the country and to the department for so long. Thank you.
Chair, just from the ACDP side, we'd also like to thank you, Dion. We've known each other for a long time, even before 1999 when I came to Parliament, even in the Justice days when I was still in the department. And again, just to endorse what the Chair said about the high standard of the legislative component and the Justice, you can be proud of the legacy that you leave. I think it's on record that Justice has passed the most number of bills when compared to any other department from 1994, and in particular that 1994 to 1999 and a little bit thereafter. It was huge amount of work. So from our side, thank you. You've set the standard of servant leadership, I think. Servant leadership. And thank you for always chatting to me in the corridors. You've always, when I first came to Parliament, you've given a lot of wise advice to us as well as new MPs, which we really appreciate. I appreciated it at the time. I wasn't aware of your role in the National Peace Accord and the Transitional Executive Council, and that's also part of a legacy, and you might want to write a book about that and record it. I think they need to be recorded, right? We need to record the role that leaders, servant leaders, have played in our nation. And just to end by saying that National Peace Accord was, you said, very difficult, but we know that the will of God says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. So thank you for that, and for in what I would think you fulfilling your purpose and destiny, but possibly the best is yet to come. Thank you very much.
on a personal level, I first met Mr. Rudman during the National Peace Accord, and then also had contact with him with the Goldstone Commission. So it's been a long time, then reconnected when I came here in 1999. Really just to echo what everybody has said, we're very sorry that you are leaving. I suppose if you do the maths, I wasn't aware of the 46 years. I think your appearance is deceptive. unless you started when you were like 15, it then maybe is getting on a bit. To thank you for everything, to wish you all the best in your retirement, to hope that you do use your skills, the experience that you've gained, to continue to contribute. Steve Swart has spoken about, I think a memoir would be very interesting, but then there's also the aspects of your skills as far as legislation and legislation drafting, so that's another area that could be looked at. But I hope that we still remain in contact.
Chair, my apologies for coming late, but I just want to add to what has been said without paraphrasing my chairperson. I want to just give you advice as a senior citizen that retirement should be viewed as a change of occupation.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the kind words. I really appreciate it. May I be excused because I have a cabinet committee meeting where further legislation will hopefully be approved to keep you busy for a while longer.
Chair, just before Mr. Radman leaves, I mean, and look, he's the most senior official from the Justice Department here, but if there are any farewell parties, I hope the committee gets invited.
I will convey the message to
you. Well, you wait, because you've not meant to know about any surprise party.
Thank you, dear. Go with our best wishes.
All right, honourable members. Back to the grindstone. Mr. Bassett, please remind me where we were yesterday.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not too sure how you want to deal with it today. Home Affairs, just to recap, have given us some documentation with some proposals on, and Engela worked late last night. Most of them are done already. Mm-hmm. But Home Affairs have to come back to us on one or two aspects. With particular reference to Clause 22, that's on the temporary residence, what it's going to look like, whether it's going to be a 31(2)(b) type of amendment or a DG mechanism that can grant temporary residence permanent, so we're still waiting for that. To remind members, I think when we were last here on the 8th of November, we were going through the document, we were going through the bill, going through the amendments that the committee had proposed on the 2nd of November, I think it was, and we got to clause 42. So we haven't really finished going through the amendments of the 2nd of November. And in between, we had a meeting on the 7th and 8th of November, so there are also those amendments that we need to do. If I may make a suggestion, unless the committee wants to go back on the Home Affairs stuff yesterday, if we could start on clause 42, dealing with the 2nd of November's amendments, and then possibly if there's time, then we can go from the beginning again and have the amendments that you discussed on the 7th and 8th. All those amendments are in the document that we handed out yesterday containing our proposals on the DHA, on the Home Affairs provisions. So the amendments for the 2nd, 7th and 8th are all on the document that we handed out yesterday.
Which is 14 November, right at the top of your working document. Mr. Jeffrey?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is the amendments from Clause 42 are the same as the 25th of October, whatever the date was, document. But I agree, let's go through those so that we bring the rest of the document up to speed.
Yeah.
And then if we've got time, look at the amendments that they've done in this 14 November document from the earlier ones. Because where we, I think, are heading for is to have this bill in a position that we can vote on it and finalize it. Chair, I mean, I think we're not going to get it through the House this year because the last week of plenaries is next week. But the issue we'd need to look at is, do we want to finalize it before we go on to recess? Because remember, committees will be sitting later, which is not bad in the sense of when everything's fresh in your mind. We have a tendency, we're human, of forgetting things. Some of us who are not present have more of a tendency than others, but so it's a question of, do we want to try and finalize it in the committee this year or early next year? The advantage of early next year is that it does give you a chance to relook at things, but at the same time it would be useful to put it to bed. We've got other bills on the table. But I think with the Home Affairs stuff, look, let's not go back to that. Let's wait for Home Affairs to finish their processes. So I think from 42 onwards, and then go back to look at the changes they made from the last meeting.
I think Mr. Jeffrey's comments are meant not just for you and your team, Mr. Bassett, but for all of us. That is, committee members and everyone else present. And that is, we hope that objective we can reach. We must certainly strive for that, but at all times, quality supersedes all else. So that's how we're looking at it. So we hope that Home Affairs quickly wrap up their side of things and get together with you and your team and resolve those few outstanding matters that we had identified yesterday. And so as a committee, if we can finalize this bill this year, then that'll be a plus. We do have a very strenuous program. Yeah.
Just add, I spoke to the Home Affairs officials yesterday, and I was even trying to get them to meet this week. Unfortunately, that's not possible. But we're hoping to meet with them early next week to finalise the outstanding things, possibly even Monday.
Okay. All right. Clause 42, then.
Chair, I'll hand over to my colleagues.
I'm working from the document, or the version 14 of the MA document. If you could start on page 62, clause 42, report to Parliament. There are no amendments to that clause. Coming to the regulations clause, you will see the footnote there. Says the changes indicated in this clause are the changes proposed to the provisions in the bill as introduced into Parliament. With regard to clause 43 sub 1, we suggest that the wording be changed. We have the minister may in the case of paragraph A and may in the case of paragraph B. It reads first the minister may in the case of paragraph B and must in the case of paragraph A. So we have just switched there. Okay. Must. It reads originally. With regard to footnote 96, this is a matter that the committee dealt with on the 23rd of August, suggesting that the Minister of Justice powers must be set out at the beginning of the clause. Originally, this clause was sub-clause 43.4 in the introduced bill, so we moved it forward. With regard to footnote 97, we deleted that paragraph. The committee on the 6th of September instructed that the regulations relating to appeals should be dealt with by the Minister of Social Development and not the Minister of Justice. So we've rectified that.
Sorry.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Just a query. must in the case of paragraph, just going back slightly to the beginning of 43, must in the case of paragraph A and may in the case of paragraph B after consultation with blah de blah. So must those people be consulted for A? My reading of it is yes, which is not the intention. Why must all these people be consulted about the manner in which prosecutors must refer suspected child and adult victims of trafficking for assessment? What is the Minister of International Relations? I mean, it's an issue. It's basically how 19.2. I mean, it's. Yeah, I don't think those people are, those ministers are needed. The other one they're all needed because that's all the ministers involved in the Act, and that's basically a mechanism to facilitate the implementation of the Act. But I don't think you need them all for 19.2, which is if during criminal proceedings the prosecutor on reasonable grounds suspects that the person is a victim of trafficking, then they must apply for postponement in the prescribed manner, conduct an assessment, you should all these cross references, conduct an assessment in terms of 15.6 and 16.8 as the case may be. So 15.6 is Provincial Department of Social Development. But anyway, it would probably be Social Development and Social Development. Yes, I'm being sarcastic if you missed that. but Chair, I think maybe the issue would be that the clauses should be divided. All these ministers must not be consulted.
Okay.
No. You see, the must is that you can't expect the it's an after consultation, okay? Yeah, but I'm saying for A, there's no need to consult those ministers on those regulations. The only minister you would be consulting would be Social Development, possibly Police, possibly Health. But international relations, home affairs, labour, state security, women, children, persons with disability, no.
Yeah. I mean, Steve's saying that as well, and I think I agree. Why should they have to make regulations regarding the manner in which they must refer? I mean, the fact that they must refer, is it necessary to make regulations as to how they must be referred?
Well, we have got the bill saying the prosecutor must in the manner prescribed, so it implies that there will be regulations. If there will be regulations, then the minister must make them. Well, no, because otherwise it's you've got a confusion in court where the prosecutor finds a child, I mean, not it's not a trafficked person, and they need to refer it, and it's not clear how they're going to refer it. So I don't think it's a bad thing to say that aspect is prescribed, and therefore the minister must make the regulations. But my point was the consultation with all these ministers is unnecessary for A. For B, it's necessary because it involves them.
But it does involve them potentially in the referral Social Development, certainly.
Yes. I mean, what I'm saying is the only one it would refer, it would be really a Social Development because they deal with it. must in the case of A after consultation with the Minister of Social Development, and if you wanted to look at Police, maybe I don't sort of see if there's a need. Home Affairs, why? I mean, remember, if you say there's a requirement for consultation, you're putting a burden on the minister for making the regulations, which means he has to send it to the ministers and get comment back. And if those ministers are doing other things because it's not their mainline function, then they may delay. So why put that burden? So I think it would be must in the case of A, after consultation with the Minister of Social Development, and you can see whether we want to include anyone else, and then may in the case of paragraph B, after consultation with the whole list here.
Yes,
I think in the other legislation that we've got, we haven't given that much thought, and what you're saying, it does make the process very difficult when you've got to consult.
Mm.
And we've learned that lesson very well. And we might need to do that in the other sub-clauses of dealing with regulations as well.
Okay.
Jeff, does that...
Mr. Swart?
Under A, then, what if the minister wants to consult with others?
He can. I think
prevents... He must make the regulations. The requirement of the Act will be he must make regulations, which he makes after consultation with the Minister of Social Development. If he so decides to consult other ministers, civil society, the committee,
yes.
And I think we need to reduce unnecessary obligations from a time point of view.
Are we agreed, honourable members? Okay. Mrs. Stain.
Thank you, Chair. Coming to footnote 98, that is subparagraph A of subclause 1. The manner in which prosecutors must refer suspected child and adult victims of trafficking for assessment. We have changed the word investigation to the word assessment to be in line with clauses 15, 6 and 16.
Sorry, Chair. Do we not have the same problem under 43.2? We've got the Minister of Home Affairs must consult.
Let's deal with this issue first.
I'm sorry.
This one first.
We're not there yet.
With regard to footnote 99, we deleted the last part there and C, only to refer to section 19.2b. In 19.2b, we combined the referral of adult victims and child victims for assessment.
Okay.
With regard to footnote 100, we added the establishment and regulation of a mechanism to facilitate the implementation of this Act as provided for in section 41.4. Because of the changes to the bills, we do not have an intersectoral committee anymore, but the DG of Justice to perform certain functions. This paragraph B was inserted to provide that the Minister may make regulations for the establishment of a mechanism to facilitate the implementation of the bill.
Right. Well, that brings us to the point the Honourable Steve Swart is raising.
Just before that, on this implementation of the Act, is
yes.
That not, and I think this also links with the next one in Home Affairs, with the discussion with Home Affairs. The implementation of the Act, yesterday we were talking about protocols or memorandums of understanding. Is that not something when you talk to Home Affairs, you might want to bring it in somewhere in the regulations? I don't know if this is an opportune place, but you might want to look there because that's it. Putting in binding protocols and memorandums of understanding.
Okay.
And then the second issue is what I raised, but obviously if I, on this issue of the Home Affairs, that now depends on your discussions with them as to this, but the principle about consulting all the ministers will then go through all the regulations. It seems that it's pretty much standard. Under three again, Minister of Social Development must consult the presidency, etc. The only concern I've got is, Jay, when you've got litigious people,
and these are,
contest the regulations. I'm not saying that you should exclude must, but by putting in may, you then are making it, you're not creating a loophole where there's not that absolute consultation with the presidency, with the minister in the presidency, the loophole. And your regulations can be struck down. Now, balanced against that, when you put the must in, that's obligatory and there's a positive side to that as well. So we've got to balance the two.
All right, Mr. Jeffrey.
Yeah, look, my reading of the must and the may is about they refer to the verb, the act of making regulations. So it's the minister must make regulations, or the minister may make regulations. The after consultation is a separate issue. It's not, and whether you put must or may doesn't make any difference. The requirement, the wording after consultation is that there must be consultation. I don't think we need to be to over-legislate, and I wouldn't agree with Mr. Swart about whether it's necessary to put in protocols and stuff like that. I mean, that's things I think we can monitor and raise, but I don't think you can specify the minister must make regulations about a protocol between the departments. But I also would share his concern around, is it necessary to put this entire requirement of consultation. What happens to the, maybe I can for you, Chair, ask, what happens to the regulations? Are they tabled in Parliament? But it's just that, look, you can never, I mean, government
yes.
is funny.
Yes.
Non-laughable
sub four.
Side. So you, one would assume there would be consultation, but sometimes there isn't. And therefore it's not a bad thing to say that there should be. But, you know, what happens, for example, if there's a reconfiguration of ministries? Okay, I know that's dealt with elsewhere, but then, although it's dealt with elsewhere, you don't have to amend the Act, then the Act doesn't read so well. So, I don't know. I mean, as it's coming to Parliament, and is that for approval or for...
Approval. I know there was a lot of debate about that, whether it should be approval or not, but at the moment it is for approval, and I'm not too sure whether the committee is going to...
Look, I mean, we've got to get to that section. I prefer the deemed approval aspect, so that Parliament can't delay, where you say, is that the approval we've got, deemed approval? But if it's coming to Parliament for deemed approval, everybody's got the opportunity. I mean, if social development pick up that, hey, they weren't consulted, then you know, then they've got an opening. So really, it's following on from Mr. Swart's point on the list. Do we need to list? Why don't we just say the minister must make regulations, and the minister may make regulations, and delete the after consultation?
Chair, not that this is an answer, but this is the way child justice went, the way sexual offences went. It seems to be a new trend, well, not so much a new trend, but a trend at a particular time. But when you think back a few years ago, before that trend began, it was always the minister may or the minister must make regulations. All this detail wasn't there. And we are being confronted, and maybe it's a good thing that this is coming up in the department itself. Sometimes we get accused, why do you have all this detail? Why do you create all these burdens? Why are there so many obligations in legislation? Why do you make it so intricate and difficult? So these questions are rising, and maybe the committee would like to think about it. I think this is really just following a trend. That sort of showed up, and maybe it is the time to go back to more uncomplicated legislation.
Mr. Jeffrey,
I think go for a new trend. I mean, I wasn't really involved with sexual offences; I was with child justice. But thinking about it, is it really necessary? And particularly where there's parliamentary approval, there's a safeguard there for ministries, departments who were not, don't feel they were adequately consulted to make an input before they could become final. So, Chair, I think what I would argue then is delete the after consultations, and that would apply to all of them. The one issue, though, if that is done, because if you go back to 41.4, and it may apply in other parts of the bill, we've got the minister may make regulations establishing and regulating the functioning of a mechanism to facilitate the implementation of this act and to coordinate responsibilities, functions and duties referred to it in this section. If you take out, and that's referred to in 43, if you take out the requirement, the only thing that 43 was adding was a requirement of consultation. So if you take out that requirement of consultation, which we are now doing, then it's just a repeat. So either 41.4 must come out where it is, but I think our general view is put all the regulations in one section. So I think then you would delete 41.4 and then provide for it under 43. And then the same I think would apply. There may be other cases where you've referred in the text, in the body of the bill, to the minister's power to make regulations and then just repeat it because you need to repeat it for the consultation requirements.
So we're moving 41.4 to the regulations clause.
There, under 43A, 1A.
Just repeat it.
Sorry, 43B. Okay, 1B.
The manage the establishment and regulation. Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, but you see they put it into the regulation section because we wanted everything in there, and then the new issue in 43 was a consultation which we've taken out. But I think, Chair, the principle should be all the regulation making powers in the regulation section away from
the rest of
the rest.
Yes,
I just think they should take four as it is there and make that B. So we just add in the section that isn't in the current B to coordinate as well responsibilities. Just take that four and then just make that B.
Okay. Use the wording in full.
Yeah. It seems to make sense. So all the consultations come out, eh? Yeah. Mr. Bassett, do these people know, obviously the Minister of Justice would know, but the Minister of Home Affairs, Minister of Social Development, and so on, that they're going to have to be required to make these regulations? I suppose at some stage they will be.
Yes. Chair, I think they've already started working on those regulations, and they've got quite far, Social Development particularly.
Yeah. And
consultant. Has consultant.
All right, fine. Yes.
Clause 43.2 provides for the Minister of Home Affairs to make certain regulations. This will relate to the manner in which a foreigner who has been issued with a letter of recognition to be a victim of trafficking will be granted approval to remain in the Republic, the manner in which the Director General of Social Development must request an extension of the recovery and reflection period, the manner in which the extension can be granted, and the manner in which a person must be informed of arrangements that have been made for his or her reception in the country to which he or she is to be repatriated. I think with regard to these sub-clauses, we will probably have to wait and see what comes up from the Department of Home Affairs before we can really finalize this.
Yeah, because they are proposing, instead of a letter of recognition, a visitor's visa.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
No, the letter wasn't related to Home Affairs.
Wasn't.
No, the letter was from the Social Development, just to say that they're a victim of trafficking, but the Home Affairs was going to be separate process completely, which is the visa. So yeah, I think we need to wait.
All right.
On that
A, that word, the verb to be, we need to look at the drafting thing, because you're not issued with a letter of recognition to be. You already, it recognizes the fact that you are a victim of fact. Maybe we can just look at the wording there, just change that.
That's covered in 101. Yeah, it's in the footnote. Okay. Yes.
It's just that that person is already a victim of trafficking, but this is the formal legal recognition of being a victim of trafficking.
Can't you say confirming that he or she is a victim?
You will also note footnote 101, there's another option there, the deletion of the words as a victim of trafficking, which follow after issued with a letter of recognition. As a letter of recognition means that the person is a victim of trafficking.
Mr. Jeffrey?
No, I mean, I don't know what we're debating. We've taken off the letter of recognition for the recovery reflection period. So this clause must basically reflect that, and you don't need the references, you don't need to get into this debate around to be or not to be. Question.
Okay.
If I can proceed to subclause 3.
Yes, Mrs. Stein.
Dealing with the regulations to be made by the Minister of Social Development. We will note that we have deleted paragraph A there regarding the form of the written consent, as the committee has decided to do away with the written consent. Paragraph F under 3, we have just indicated the MEC as the MEC has been defined in the clause, so we don't need to refer to the member of the Executive Council.
Mm-hmm. Sarcastic comment, so I didn't really take it seriously until I was reading it again the other day. But in the Western Cape, we have a constitution which refers to MECs as ministers. Is that relevant? Should it be distinguished? Or, I mean, I think the constitution says MECs. Am I right? Mm-hmm. So we can. So it will be fine. It will cover that, even if they call that.
The constitution says that, yeah.
Coming to still in paragraph F, the manner in which the MEC must deal with an appeal as provided for in section 16A, capital A2. The footnote there says that on 6 September the committee indicated that these two responsibilities should remain with the Minister of Social Development. And I am just trying to see what we have the...
Mr. Jeffrey?
I'm not sure what is... I'm just looking at 26... Sub 26 on page 28.
26, you mean 16?
Mm-hmm. Look, we basically, where we were saying social development is social development rather than the accredited organizations.
because this responsibility for appeals, you know, it's correct that I think it's with the MEC. I don't know if the issue is, excuse me, MEC versus minister, but I would have thought in this basis it's more appropriate MEC in terms of decentralisation. The issue was on G, where you've given us the option of provincial department of social accredited organisation and or, where we have already resolved its social development.
So F stays as it is.
So I think F is fine. G on 16A3, there's a footnote. It's basically if the appeal is unsuccessful or the person doesn't appeal, and if the person is an illegal foreigner, he or she must be referred by the Provincial Department of Social Development, by the Department of Home Affairs, to be dealt with in terms of existing immigration legislation. And the footnote there is that we said the subclause doesn't seem to be necessary. All that is required is the Department of Social Development to refer an illegal foreigner to the Department of Home Affairs for possible deportation. I'm raising it here because G refers to 16A3, so that's the one I've read. But it's not a bad thing to spell out that's what's going to happen, because there may be disputes about it. Although I think A3 should change to existing immigration legislation to sure it would be the Immigration Act, going back to that. But then on 3G, it would be the manner in which the provincial department must deal with the affected person, so deleting accredited organization.
Accredited organization also comes out.
Yeah.
Mr. Swart?
Just a very small point, and that is numbering. When we refer to a 16A, we have to, surely when we're doing a new poll, you're going to take that out.
Yes.
And refer to the constitution.
Yes, because I think there's still going to be some further changes where we relocate provisions, especially here.
Are we going to relook at all these array of ministers again, beginning of the clause 3.
I thought we should. Right. Huh? I thought we had agreed.
We had
yeah.
Agreed. Good morning.
I'm just saying, from his note, that must be done.
All right. Okay. All right, Mrs. Stein.
On page 65, paragraph N, that is something that has been inserted, the form of the plan referred to in section 28.2. If I can read to you, which the plan referred to in subsection 1, which must conform as far as possible to the form as prescribed, must include an exit plan and be brought to the attention of the victim and signed by him or her. Subclause 4, at the end of page 65.
Mm-hmm.
This deals with any regulations made under this section must be submitted to Parliament for approval. We originally had 30 days, but it has been amended to 60 days prior to publication thereof in the Gazette. And then B, which provides regulations which are not approved within the 60-day period referred to in paragraph A are deemed to have been approved by Parliament.
That's good. Yeah. It's bad enough as it is now. Sorry, Mrs. Stein. So we take out that long list of people after consultation as well, eh?
Yes.
Mrs. Jeffrey.
This one I'm no, the issue is, this is the other was ministers and regulations. This is now officials.
Okay.
And the ministers sit fortnightly in cabinet. The DGs sit quarterly in FOSAD, and it's not the same structure. It's not a statutory body. So I'm more inclined to this requirement of the list of officials that they must consult than I see it in a different category to the ministers. So while we've agreed that the minister consultation comes out because they sit there, they are a recognised collective, statutory collective, the officials are not necessarily. The difficulty is that these issues under the national directives require the active participation and support of the relevant departments. So if you say the DG of Justice can just issue them, and they haven't properly consulted, then you're not going to get cooperation. Yeah. But you see, the difference with the ministers is that cabinet is a collective and it meets regularly and decisions get taken. It isn't the same collective, and there are cab committees and things like that. There isn't the same statutory collective for DGs. So I don't know what the officials feel, because it's you know how things work better than we do in that area. But my fear is, because it involves the active support and the implementation by these departments, then it is in cooperation that it's necessary. Otherwise, you could just find not this DG, but some other DG just somewhere issuing directives.
The chair, sorry, the lady from Home Affairs landed up at the wrong venue. I just had to go and phone her. You're saying that we do need the consultation with, and I would tend to agree with that in these circumstances. I think my colleague from Vulnerable Groups will bear me out on that. Kamakhela, you are involved, I know, with a whole range of these sort of things, and there are problems I experience when the functionaries aren't tied down.
Could be must where applicable, because I'm just looking at two measures to be taken in instances where foreign victims of trafficking are not conversant with any official languages of the Republic. I presume that there's not a, you know, all these bodies should not have to be. So maybe if we just limit it with.
Just going against his own argument, he just said earlier that the must doesn't relate to the consultation, and if you say must where applicable, then it will relate to the consultation. So we must rather say after consultation with either
or... After consultation with where applicable.
Yeah.
After consultation where applicable with. But something that basically is... You see the...
Can we say it was too vague? After consultation with whichever departments the DG deems relevant in each case? Or was that too vague?
Look, surely an after consultation is, we sent them the stuff, we gave them a month, They never, we sent them 5 reminders, they never responded, we consulted.
That's it. Yes.
May I proceed, sir?
Please, Mrs. Stone.
Clause 1A2 has been deleted as the committee decided on the 6th of September that the DG of Social Development must issue directives in this regard. So that has been moved. The same goes for paragraph 4, the referral of victims of trafficking to social health care and psychological services. Coming to page 67, footnote 113, it reads, on 6 September the committee indicated that paragraph C should be deleted, but that an obligation should be imposed on the DGs in question to submit inputs and information to the Department of Justice in preparing the directives, and therefore paragraph C has been adapted to give effect to the request of the committee.
Can I
proceed?
Yes, please.
And maybe Miss Stange should just go forth, and then we stop her if we want to.
Right. Yes, go forth. Sounding very biblical.
On page 68, subclause 4, there is also a consultation process with the Director of General Home Affairs, and I assume that it must also be amended likewise as we are going to do in the others.
Do we want that long list there, Honourable Members? Page 68, sub 4.
Yes.
So they remain.
The next footnotes on page 70, Subclause 6 and 7 are new and give effect to the committee's request on 6 September that the Director General of Social Development must issue directives. These are the ones that were originally placed in the clause dealing with the directives to be issued by the Director General of Justice. So it has been moved in here.
I presume DSD's got no problem with publishing in the Gazette like Home Affairs.
I suppose we have to discuss it with them. They haven't indicated any problems.
The justice directives must be tabled for 30 days. Does that apply to everyone else? I see it for Home Affairs
and Social Development.
The National Commission of Police.
I don't think it's for the police. And to ask Ms. Dearman to come in here, I think the national directives for police aren't being tabled. Or Engela. A reason for that, I see Mr. Haldanais says, I just can't recall.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, we said we must be extremely cautious in the publication of those directives because it may influence or it may enable traffickers or would-be traffickers to understand exactly what the police will be doing in order to counter the actions.
I think in other legislation where these were, the police doesn't get tabled either.
Okay, fair enough. Ms. Steelman.
Chair, just to take you back, starting on the bottom of page 69, subclause 5, dealing with the Director General Labour, going over to page 70. I know we have deleted that because most of that is covered in the first subclause. I just want to refer you to subsection 6B on page 70, where the Director General Labour must provide an annual report on any relevant information for all the other departments we have included there. And my question is whether the Director General Labour should not also be responsible for providing the DG of Justice with any relevant information, because nowhere we have covered it.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Is that not covered under page 67? Under C. The functionaries listed, of which one of them is Labour, must provide information to the DG Justice in preparing the directives that are referred to in A. I think it's covered, yeah.
What do you see?
Page 72 of the document, subclause 10. It provides that the National Commissioner of the South African Police, the NDPP, and the Director General Home Affairs, Labour and Social Development must each develop training courses which must include training, also incorporating social context training on the national instructions or directives as the case may be. You will note that we still refer to the Department of Labour, and as we have deleted the Department of Labour in subclause 5, the question arises whether it should still be part of this clause. It relates to training as well as to develop training courses, which include training on the instructions and directives, as well as to provide for the use of uniform norm standards and procedures.
Chair, just to add on to that, I noticed that we have this, we have included labour under subsection 1, so I think perhaps we should leave it under that clause, because given the fact that they covered under subsection 1, they might be required to also develop training courses.
All right.
Coming to footnote 115 on page 72, we now come to the delegation of powers and assignment of duties. We originally provided for the assignment of delegation of powers and assignment of duties by the National Commission of South African Police Service or the Director General to senior officials. The South African Police indicated to us that Section 15 of the South African Police Service Act already provides for delegation of powers, and that the reference to SAPS could be deleted from these clauses dealing with the delegation of powers. So we have taken out the reference to the National Commission of the South African Police. If you can go further on page 73, the footnote continues there. On 23 August, the committee re-questioned the need for this delegation provision and asked whether this is not already covered by the Public Service Act. Other examples of acts which contain specific provisions on delegation and assignment are found in the Children's Act, where duties, the delegation of powers and duties imposed on the minister, the MEC, the DG and the provincial head can be delegated. There are provisions in the Immigration Act in Section 3, in the Refugees Act, Section 7.1. The Refugees Amendment Act, which still must come into force, adds delegations by the DG, the national, the minister, the MEC, the DG and the provincial head. The Human Tissue Act, which is still in operation, provides in Section 38 for delegations by the minister, the DG, as well as an inspector. The Public Service Act only provides in Section 42, Capital A, for delegations of powers and duties imposed on functionaries in terms of that Act, which deals with the organization and administration of the public service. So there's not a sort of a overall general delegation. We raised the matter with the Department of Social Development and they indicated that they would want specific provisions regarding the delegation of powers and the assignment of duties.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Yeah, I mean, having read the footnote, I propose that we accept Clause 45 as it is, as amended.
Okay. Chair, there are certain provisions that we're saying should not be delegated. So I think that's important as well.
And can those, Chair, just be checked with the relevant DGs? I see it's primarily Home Affairs.
Okay.
Page 73, footnote 116, I think that's what Lawrence has just indicated, that the view is that there should be provisions that should not be delegated.
Mm.
Footnote 117 is samely.
Chair, that's the one
changed,
that's the one I'd asked. I was a bit ahead of you to say, can that just be checked with those relevant DGs?
Yes. I have to be really only finalised once Home Affairs have come back to us as well, so that we know fully what the functionaries are going to be doing.
Footnote 117 on page 73 is basically the same as the footnote in 115. That is with regard to clause 46. On page 74, footnote 118, we also will have to check with the Director General, because we have also indicated some provisions there that should not be delegated. Footnote 119 is also the same as the previous one. On page 75, subclause 4, subclause 3, footnote 120, this deals with the delegation of powers by provincial head. And the question was raised whether provincial head should be able to delegate downwards. it might not be appropriate, bearing in mind the provisions in question, for example, the accrediting of organizations in Clause 24, and the confirmation of persons as victims of trafficking in Clause 16. It might be mentioned, though, that Section 311 of the Children's Act provides for the delegation of powers by the provincial league to an officer in the employ of the province concerned, or to an organ of state by agreement with that organ of state. The provincial league has a variety of powers and duties in terms of the Children's Act, for example, consideration of applications of powers of organizations, approval for HIV testing of certain children. The provincial head may also assign certain functions to municipalities, for example, Section 88, which allows him to assign duties with regard to the registration of partial care facilities to a municipality.
Yeah, I propose we keep it as it is, that this is relating to the accreditation organizations and the letter of recognition. And that because of the potential for abuse and the fact that it entitles the recognized person to state benefits, that must be exercised by the provincial head. There is always a provincial head, so even if the head of social development in the province is off sick, there's an acting head. Because presumably the actings are covered.
I just would like to point out in subclause 4 on page 75, a provincial head may not assign a power or duty. I think there's just a word missing there. May not delegate a power or assign a duty. We just have to rectify that.
Okay.
On page 76, footnote 122, it is there found in subclause 2. On 6 September, the committee indicated that subclause 1 should be deleted and that provision be made for the minister to issue a directive in terms of which existing organizations can continue to provide services after the commencement of this act, should that be necessary, subject to their having applied for accreditation. Mm-hmm. And then coming to the short title, but I think we have already dealt with this footnote regarding the short title of the bill.
Yep. Delete.
Yeah. So, Chair, most of those footnotes, I think, can we, as we agreed last time, we'll take them out in the next draft that we prepare.
Yes, please.
And then, Chair, we come to the schedule, and I think the schedule, we have worked on it, but it keeps on having to be worked on again as a result of discussions. And we're still waiting for Home Affairs proposals, so that'll have a further effect on what the schedule will look like eventually.
Fair enough.
Yeah, the only thing with the schedule is whether we want to look at any of the, and I think we should be guided by Mr. Bassett, whether we need to look at any of the footnotes. Are there issues of a sort of, I mean, the schedule should be consequential amendments.
Yes.
So I'm not sure why all the footnotes, because are there policy issues we should be looking at?
I'm going to ask Angela and Louisa to assist there.
I think the most important issue that the committee must look at is many of the amendments of the acts in the schedule are aimed at replacing the provisions of Section 71, 1 or 2 of the Criminal Law, the Sexual Offences Amendment Act. Now, Section 71 deals with the offence of trafficking in persons for sexual purposes, and Section 71(2) deals with the offence of involvement in trafficking in persons for sexual purposes. the Sexual Offences Amendment Act does not provide for other trafficking related offences as provided for in this bill. So we, in many places we are referring to all the offences in Chapter 2 and not only to the trafficking offence. So that is something that we need to look at. And then the offence of involvement in trafficking in persons in Clause 10 covers all the other offences in Chapter 2 of the bill, and also not trafficking in persons, and therefore special reference must be made to that. That is the main issue which I think that we should look at.
May I just add, I think we have discussed it on previous occasions, what also was added at the request of the NPA, or Asset Forfeiture Unit, was that we include in the schedule to poker the offences in the bill, and that we've done as well.
But just in summary, the footnotes do not deal with policy issues, basically just explaining why we have inserted certain amendments.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I had to deliver a comment on the air consultations. I noticed that we didn't include SARS as one of the departments that should be consulted or part of these air coordination mechanisms, because they are responsible for ports of entries and they have a border organization control committee that would actually influence combating of trafficking, even though they don't have specific responsibility. They have responsibility towards combating at ports of entry.
Just on that point, the customs officials, are they not Home Affairs or are they SARS?
SARS.
Should we include them? That will only be under the directives then. And national instructions.
The chair obviously can SARS be checked with as to what they think of it, and then let us know.
Yeah, before that. Yeah, I'm listening.
No, see, it was a lighter procedural note. I went to the gym this morning, chair, and I sat in the sauna. I wasn't anticipating that I was going to remain in the sauna.
Mr. Bassett. So, Chair, that brings us to the end of the bill. As I said earlier, we do have, then I think we met after that, and we got further instructions, so we could possibly go to the start of the bill again and deal with, and we can do that.
Before you do that, let me hear the Honourable Debbie
Chair. Sure, I've also got two other issues, but they relate to beginning of the bill, so I don't know if you want me to just do it as we go through it again, or if I can just...
As we go through it. All right. Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. I'm wondering, I hope I'm not abusing this, before we start that, when Engel and I were working on the provisions from Home Affairs yesterday, we came across a few things that I would like to get guidance now, and that will help us with the drafting of the bill once we meet with Home Affairs as well. If I could take you back to those specific, it's really just some suggestions, and I'd like to test the committee on what we have thought about, and it relates to where we should put the provisions, those three provisions dealing with the recovery and reflection period, temporary residence and permanent residence. May I just raise that in case we don't get as far as that in the bill today? It will help us with the drafting.
Let's do that, yeah.
Chair, it's not going to take long. If you have a look at the... maybe it'd be useful to go to the index of the bill. That gives you an idea of the arrangement of the chapters and the provisions. And we were requested to try and accommodate Chapter 4 elsewhere in the bill. And chapter four deals with, as I say, the status of foreign victims. Our suggestion at this stage would be to make chapter four part of chapter three. Chapter three deals with identification and protection of victims of trafficking. And basically what those three provisions do is they are some form of protection for victims of trafficking, although they are foreign victims of trafficking. And what we have in mind is a provision we can slot it in chapter three under protection of victims of trafficking. Have one provision, it might be quite long, but call it, and we're thinking of a heading now for that, is protective measures for purposes of investigation and prosecution in respect of foreign victims of trafficking. And then to have one provision dealing, firstly, you'll start off with your recovery and reflection period, go on to, like a seamless flow, start off with the recovery and reflection period, go on to your, whatever it's going to be, clause 22 type thing, either a ministerial exemption or a DG permit. And then the last subsection would be, right at the end of the process, the section 31.2b of the Immigration Act, exemption, which the NDBP would apply for on behalf of a witness. That's just an idea that we came up with, and I'd like to test that. It will help us with the drafting.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, this relates, chapter 4 relates specifically to victims who are needed for the investigation of the offences, which is chapter 2. So it doesn't actually relate anything to identification and protection of victims generally. So I don't think it belongs, that the provisions of chapter 4 belong in chapter 3 at all. Because chapter 3 is general, it's the letter of recognition and healthcare facilities and the prohibition of prosecutions. I'm just looking at the content page. Whereas 2 is the one that this provision in chapter 4 is there to assist with the prosecution of the offences penalties listed in chapter 2. So to my mind, it's either that they chapter 4 goes into chapter 2 at the end, or it remains as a separate chapter, but it comes after chapter 2. Because the way I would see it is you set out your crimes, your offences, and you then, this is how you can help prosecute. So maybe keep it as a separate chapter with a different heading, because it's not an offence penalty. But I don't think it belongs in identification and protection of victims of trafficking, because that is general. And then the rest of the chapter is accreditation of organizations, compensation, repatriation, general administration. So I think what I'm suggesting, Chair, is keep it as a separate chapter, but move it after 2.
After chapter 2. So it becomes 3.
Yeah. It's not part. Not part of 2, which is just offences, penalties, and extrajudicial. You see, it might if you include extraterritorial jurisdiction for the commission of offences, this is how you prosecute offences. So I don't know. I mean, a vague proposal of having it in 2, but if it's not, definitely not in 3. But if it's not in 2, have it as a separate chapter, but immediately after 2. I see Ms. Schaefer's disagreeing with it being in 2, but I'm not sure how on the ball she is. She's drunk her coffee. I don't know if Mr. Swart or other members can comment rather, Chair, to you.
Rather than Ms. Schaefer.
Yes, because I'm just worried about
the Honourable Debbie Schaefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Jeffrey needs some coffee now. I mean, how status of foreign victims relates to offences in extraterritorial jurisdiction, I have no idea, and I would not support that. I think it should be a separate chapter. We could move it after chapter 2, yes, but I don't think, you know, it's not, you're not looking at prosecuting necessarily foreign victims of trafficking, and I don't think that it's a good thing to link the two together in one chapter.
But Chair, sorry, it's not the foreign victims of trafficking per se. It is, I mean, what's the title going to, the chapter going to be called? It's going to be status of foreign victims required to assist in the investigation or something like that, because remember we've linked it specifically. So it's a lot narrower than foreign victories. It's not an offence, but it's just that because you included extraterritorial jurisdiction, which is a process point,
Let's put it separate.
Okay, all right.
He's holding the check.
Thank you for that, Chair. And we can go to the beginning of the bill and...
Let's do that. Take us through. Mrs. Stein, are you going to do it?
On page 5 of the document.
Page 5.
Yes. You will see originally the clause 47 has been deleted, but that has been that must be reinstated, clause 47. And then of course we will look at the numbering when we near to the end. On page 6 of the document, footnote 3, last time we discussed the definition of accredited organization means an organization including a government facility, and then the committee asked us to look at the word institution, which we had replaced the facility with. The state law advisors had a problem originally. I don't know if Ms. Williams would come in here with a definition of the inclusion of a government institution in the definition, but I think we have sorted that out. Suraya?
Thank you. It's just that we were unsure because of the provisions, but they met with the Department of Social Development because we really think, do they want government facilities also to be accredited to provide the services, or is it only to provide outside organizations to be accredited?
That was a specific request from Social Development that they would like government facilities also to be accredited.
Good. Nothing on page 7?
Nothing on page 7, Mr. Chair. On page 8, I just came across something that wasn't really discussed before, but which I would just like to have the committee's guidance on with regard to the definition of protective custody. Which reads, for the purposes of section 16, means the detention or confinement of a person by the adult by the South African Police Service, and then it goes on. And I was just wondering whether we should not refer to the confinement of an adult person by the South African Police Service, because we have protective custody. That is only with regard to clause 16. I don't think it will be a problem because we are referring to section 16 dealing with adult victims. I was just
I would have just said what we do is by putting adult victim.
Okay. On the same?
Not the same issue, but a different page.
Right.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just under removal of body parts. First of all, I think it became quite clear last time we discussed that issue that we do need some kind of definition of body parts.
Okay.
Secondly, the wording there is rather unfortunate, I think. It says, means the forced removal of or trade in any organ or other body part from a living person who has been trafficked, or the body of a deceased person. I don't think it can be anything other than forced of a deceased person. And I think we just need to put a comma there after trafficked. For the forced removal of a living person who's been trafficked, or the removal of or trade in the body parts of a deceased person. I mean, or the removal. Sorry, or just comma afterwards. But yeah, you can't refer to forced removal from a deceased person.
You just repeat your suggestion.
After the word trafficked, from a living person who has been trafficked, comma, or the removal from the body of a deceased person. Not forced removal. I mean, they don't have a choice to resist removal if they did.
You're mooting the possibility of using the word unlawful instead of forced.
Yeah. Unlawful.
But I mean, this is making it unlawful, so.
It's already unlawful.
Mm.
I think unlawful is better because a traffic victim could consent.
Yes.
To their kidney being removed, but it's unlawful.
It's still unlawful. Yes.
And you want to actually stop people being trafficked to remove body parts, whether they agree to it because they think they're going to get money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where it's forced means you sort of like hold them down.
Okay,
and
that's fine, then it'll relate to that.
Yeah. Saint Augustine's case in point. Yeah. I'm sorry, Mrs. Williams.
Mm. Thanks, G. Can I propose a proposal for the definition removal of body parts means the unlawful removal of or trade in any organ or other body part from a person who has been trafficked, or the body of a deceased who has been trafficked and killed for the purpose of unlawfully removing any organ or body part in contravention of the National Health Act. The reason why I want to take living person out, because sometimes the person could be living at the time and the person may die as a result of the removal, and to say whether the person was in fact living at the time. So just to remove living and to leave person there. Okay.
Okay.
The question was, what is a body part? Now, I don't know whether that's covered by your definition in the Act, because Mario was raising issues about whether blood is covered and whether sperm is covered and those kind of things, and that was where the issues were coming in, because we weren't sure whether that was classified as a body part, and some of us felt it was and some of us felt it wasn't, and I think there was a definition in the National Health Act which indicated that that wouldn't be covered by that. So I mean, we need to just check whether that definition you've got will then include that topic. In the footnote that we need to still refer to the Human Tissue Act because it's still there. So I don't know how they're going to do that now if it's going to be repealed.
Mm. Mr. Jeffrey?
Yeah. A little bit technical, but the living and the dead. It's the unlawful removal or trade of a body part from a living person who has been trafficked, or the body of a deceased person who has been trafficked, or who was trafficked. I'm not sure that bit at the end, the killing for the sole purpose of removing the body parts. Well, no, we took the soul out, but killed for the purpose of removing body parts. You have some people who are trafficked, okay, and they happen to die. And then somebody, one of the syndicates, has a bright idea, okay, let's look. So the intention wasn't to harvest their body parts. The purpose was to get them to do something else, hard labor, whatever, sexual exploitation, whatever. And they then happen to die, and somebody then has the bright idea of, okay, let's sell their body parts. So my worry is basically the definition is limited to people who are trafficked with the intention of removing their body parts. I'm proposing making it wider to cover a situation where somebody is trafficked not for the intention of harvesting body parts, but because you've got them in the country, you had them for something else, opportunist thing, and they then die for one reason or another, and you then think, hey, let's might as well make some money out of their body parts. So it would be basically means the unlawful removal of or trade in an organ, a body part from a living person who was trafficked or a deceased person who was trafficked. Who was trafficked while they were still alive, something like that. And then maybe keep the contravention of National Health Act. But I don't know if you, but yeah, but it was just more that the latter part killed for the purpose of removing. I don't know if removing soul is sufficient. And then I think, yeah, the body parts thing.
Is that not covered in the other act?
I don't think it was. I think that was the problem last time.
Oh.
The Human Tissue Act only defines human tissue and not body part per se.
And the
Can I read to you?
Yes, please.
It defines organ, that is the National Health Act, defines organ as meaning any part of the human body adapted by its structure to perform any particular vital function, including the eye and its accessories, but does not include skin and appendages, flesh, bone marrow, body fluid, blood and origami, and tissue means human tissue and includes flesh, bone, a gland, an organ, skin, bone marrow or body fluid.
Okay, so then
yeah.
The body part or
tissue. Mr. Jeffrey?
Do we want to look? I don't know. I think what was the issue that was excluded? Blood and sperm.
Mm.
Chair Christine's just got a hand up.
Sorry, Christine, I couldn't see you. Eggs, yes. Surrogacy. Yeah. Where? National Health Act?
Excludes blood or gamete.
Gamete is included in tissue.
No, tissue?
Yes, okay. Tissue means human tissue and includes flesh, bone, gland, organ, skin, bone, marrow.
But excludes.
Sorry.
What's gamete?
Gamete is an egg, or presumably it includes sperm as well.
Okay.
Yeah, gamete is a
picture. You see, I think we should cover, it would be possible that somebody, that people get trafficked. With the intention of harvesting their blood. And then I think particularly with women, maybe their eggs. So I think we should have a, I think it would be then to the drafters, what about a definition of body part which refers to organ and tissue in terms of those relevant pieces and includes blood and gametes.
And eggs, actually.
Well, gametes are eggs.
No, but gametes, I think, are fertilized eggs. So you don't necessarily only want fertilized.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think so.
Chair, through you to Christine. She seemed to be the expert.
Yes. All right.
I think eggs are ova, and I think gametes are fertilized eggs, which we want to include also non-fertilized eggs.
You mustn't go on. Telling what I said. No, we're feeling hot. Just set it so that we feel cool. He wasn't here, but he knows it wasn't hot. All right.
But just to be clear, the intention then is we can use the existing definitions in other laws, but we want to include blood, gametes and ova. If ova is not included, I don't know if you really want to include sperm. I mean,
you haven't won. How? I didn't know there was a game or match on. Contest? Was there a contest? I don't know. They say they haven't won. I'm not sure what. you want to exclude sperm.
You see, you can. Will you find men being trafficked for the purposes
sperm.
Of their sperm?
Probably not.
I mean, it just is. Look, we do want to cover every eventuality, but I can't. Whereas I think it is feasible that women could be trafficked for their ova.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Good enough. All right.
And Chair, I see this subclause 5, health is not sure when the rest of the Human Tissue Act will be repealed. So I think the principle we're giving the draft as Chair is to use existing legislation that is not subject for repeal at any point. But use existing definitions. But is it not, is the issue not tissue? Is tissue not all encompassing? And that is that in
No, that is a dominant issue.
Tissue is in the National Health Act, right?
Yeah, but it includes.
And tissue includes organ, which is also defined. So would one not be saying tissue in terms of the National Health Act because it includes the definition of organ, so you don't need to say organ as well, and then blood, gamete, and ova.
If ova is not covered as a gamete. Okay. Some of us did biology as well.
All right. Can I, honourable members, before we ask Mrs. Stain to move on, let's have a 15-minute break for tea, coffee, please.
Biology Online: a reproductive cell. A gamete is a reproductive cell or sex cell that contains a haploid set of chromosomes, e.g. spermatozoa or sperm cell, male reproductive cell, and egg cell or ovum, female
reproductive. And you reckon men, women can do something without the egg? Oh, okay. So you still need a man.
I don't think anyone has known about that. Just increase the nugget of blueberries.
Blueberries.
Simple blueberries.
They are the regular.
You can do that all the other thing.
You can have somebody. You can have one man.
Yes, I know.
Closing.
Thank you. Freedom Charter says the people shall share.
Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, let's begin where we left off. Mrs. Steyn.
Thank you, Chair. I guess we finished with the definition of.
Yes, and Mrs. Schaefer has very kindly reminded us that gamete includes the male sperm.
And ova.
And ova.
We still want to specify ova because people might want the eggs alone without being fertilized.
Why would you want the eggs alone?
They do, because then they can fertilize them somewhere else.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, Schaefer's just no. That's what we want, but that's covered by gametes.
It's not.
Anyway, that can be checked, Chair, and yeah.
A gamete is a fertilized.
It's
egg.
Not a fertilized egg. Go back.
Okay.
Let's go back.
Are you going to hold us up?
No, I've got it.
No, carry on, Chair. Will.
Yeah. All right, Mrs. Steyn, please proceed. Yes.
We were asked to delete the words off the sixth place, but we did. There's just an explanation in footnote 6 where it originally came from, that it was inserted to be in line with the definition of forced labour, where the words are found in paragraph B of that definition.
Okay.
Going to page 10, footnote 7. You see, at this stage, the definition of social service professional is in bold in brackets, indicating the deletion thereof. But if the committee is going to decide on the reporting clause, which of the reporting clauses to use, that this definition might be necessary, or we might need to delete this.
Ms. Schaefer just needs to say something to the committee.
Well, let's deal with this footnote 7 on page 10 first.
We were asked to draft two options to the reporting clause in clause 16.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on which one the committee is going to decide on, this definition will either have to go or to remain.
Right. We'll take the decision when we get to the clause 16. All right. Fine.
Yeah, Debbie apologizes to she wished she could read properly like she supposedly did at school when she got the A for biology.
On page 11, footnote 8, at the last, one of the last meetings, the committee decided not to have the protocol as a schedule.
Mm-hmm.
We had a look through the bill. There are some clauses that still refer to the protocol in clause 33, clause 37, and clause 38. So we have just deleted the words, the English text of which is replicated in Schedule 2, so we still have a definition of the protocol.
I don't think I'm being stupid, but I mean, 2-2. We still keep on referring to suspected when we said we didn't want to have suspected. Now, why are we saying to have known or suspected?
We're not there yet. No, we're not,
oh, we're not there.
No. We're still dealing with the protocol at the top of the page. No, no. Agreed? All right. What are you agreeing to?
What we agreed to last time we were in the protocol.
All right, fine. Okay.
Chairman, if I can come in for clause 2, this is what Ms. Schaefer started talking about. We were asked to have a look at how the offence clauses relate to clause 2. And we have had a look, but we haven't done the amendments for that because we would like to just get the committee's final views on that. The question was raised, if we go, I don't think there was any problem with clause 2 itself, but if you go to the, let's go to the first, let's perhaps go to the page 15 where some of the offences are, clause, and no, they're not. Or, yeah, clause 7. Yes. The question arose, isn't this overkill? If you've got clause 2, do you need to have all that, like, for instance, that we have in clause 7? Clause 7 talks about no suspects or ought reasonably to have known or suspected. We haven't changed that. What Engela did do, she spoke to the people at the NPA and they said it won't do any harm to keep it like that, but I do think it is overkill. If you have a look at POCA, which has exactly the same provision, word for word, as we do have in clause 2, and you have a look at the offences, I think that will give us the lead on how to take it forward. If, for instance, section 4 of POCA, which criminalises money laundering, says any person who knows ought reasonably to have known, and that's what POCA does throughout its offences. So you don't need the suspects and all that sort of thing. It's covered in clause 2. We've left the suspected in because, as I say, we did have a discussion with the NPA. My feeling is that we should follow what was done in POCA and just talk about who knows or ought reasonably to have known.
Mr. Swift? Chair, we had a lengthy document here from the NPA, the meaning of expression of all suspected a fact. Now, I appreciate it could be unnecessary, but we want to buttress the prosecution as much as possible. The FIC Act, Financial Intelligence Centre Act, refers to ought reasonable to have known or suspected. So we have got other legislation. They gave us a long explanation. There's a 12-page explanation as to why they wanted or suspected in. So I would suggest, why take something away that can assist the prosecution? And so I'm not convinced that we should take it out. We've got it in other legislation, and it just buttresses the prosecution. So I'm not keen to, at this stage, concede that we should take it out. I think this is a very sensitive issue that we've decided not to put in POCA things. We've watered down a lot of the prosecutors' issues that they've raised. But maybe I must put the question to Mr. Bassett. Is he saying the NPA no longer wants it in? He's saying that they say that it might not necessarily be necessary, but why have we got it in the FIC Act as well? So there is other legislation that it is included in.
I don't think, you know, when I had the discussion, it was with Mr. Nell, I didn't ask him about referring to that document, whether he's changed his mind. He simply said that it won't do any harm to have it there.
So my concern is just, what does it mean? We're saying knows, and knowing has got a certain meaning. Then we're saying ought reasonably to have known or suspected. What does suspected then mean? If you ought reasonably to have known, surely that covers you. I mean, if we want to flag it, maybe Mr. Bassett can just go back again to the NPA and just confirm with them. But I really don't see what it means. To me, it confuses things.
Mr. Jeffrey?
If you look at Clause 7, which has the suspected, and I note that suspected is
a new addition, I mean, not an introduced bill,
then you go to Clause 2.2, which defines what ought reasonably to have known means. And there's an inclusion there of ought reasonably to have known or suspected a fact means, and it lists it. My problem is it links the two together, and it's not clear to me what the difference is. So that's why I'm supporting the view that it's better to have known, which is defined under 2.1, and ought reasonably to have known, which defines what it is, which is the same definition as suspected. So I don't know why suspected is there. So to me it looks fine as ought reasonably to be knows, which is the definition given under 2.1, and ought reasonably to have known, which is the definition given under 2.2. If there was a third definition under 2.3 of what suspected is,
then it would imply there's a difference between suspected and ought reasonably to have known. But there isn't. So therefore, I can't see the point of suspected. I appreciate Mr. Swart's concerns that we want to be as broad, as tight as possible. But my worry is that this provision of suspected, where you use the word, in the charge sheet, you use the word suspected instead of ought reasonably to have known, it could be open to challenge. So I think that the point I'm making, Steve, is that suspected wasn't originally there. It's been put in, okay? But if you look at the as far as I can see, if you can look at the offences sections, suspected is a new addition, and then under 2.2 with the definition of what is ought reasonably to have known, there's no difference between ought reasonably to have known or suspected. So I don't see the point of suspected. I think it adds confusion. If we wanted to say this, it's repeating again, sorry, but just emphasizing the point. If we wanted to use suspected, we need to assign a meaning to it that is different to ought reasonably to have known.
First, let me hear Mr. Feldenace, and then I'll get back to you, honourable members.
Thank you, Chief. I think from a criminal law perspective, there is a huge difference between ought reasonably to have known and ought reasonably to have suspected. There is a difference because known means the person should have had knowledge. Now, suspicion is a lower level. In other words, you should have suspected that something was wrong there. But you cannot say that the person should have known that something was wrong.
Mr. Jeffrey first, and then Mr. Swart.
Yeah, but Mr. Feldenace, we're not talking about ought reasonably to have suspected. No. We're talking about suspected. So you've got the concept of knowledge, knowing. You've got the concept of ought reasonably to have known. What is the difference between ought reasonably to have known and suspected? Because if you look at 2.2, they are both lumped together and with the point that if the conclusions that he or she ought to have reached or those which would have been reached by a reasonably diligent and vigilant person having both the general knowledge, skill, and etc., and so on, they're put together. So I agree there's a difference between knowledge and suspicion. But the concepts in this bill are knowledge, or reasonably to have known, those are the two. And then, and the issue is, ought reasonably to have known, what is the difference between that and suspected? Because it's not ought reasonably to have suspected, it's just suspected. And can you achieve the mens rea element necessary for the conviction for a crime on a suspicion? It's knowledge. Mens rea is knowledge.
Mr. Feldenace?
Yes, I think the remarks are valid. However, I think one must also bear in mind that when we talk about ought reasonably to have suspected, it is not included in the section itself. But perhaps we should insert it. Because it is different from ought reasonably to have known. In fact, I do not understand what we want to achieve by saying ought reasonably to have known, because that implies you should have had knowledge of that fact, whilst it should be enough if you should have suspected and at least raised certain issues and raised the questions in order to satisfy yourself.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Yeah, I mean, it's the mens rea element requirement, and maybe the NPA can assist. You've got to prove an intention, and no, it's not the mens rea aspect. Actually, I'm wrong. But anyway, yeah, maybe it is. But you've got to have for a conviction in a criminal case. You've got to have it's intention, but you've got to have knowledge of the crime. Now, we've broadened it slightly to say we're including, which has been done in our law before, the ought reasonably to have known element. But can you actually get convictions? Is it constitutionally permissible to get convictions on suspicion? And ought reasonably to have suspected is even wider. So I feel that knowledge and ought reasonably to have known are as far as we can go.
Right, Mr. Swart.
And
have, in Powell versus Fundamenta, the term suspicion was used in the context of what we've got it here. Ought reasonable to have known or suspected, and was dealt with in depth by our courts. So there is jurisprudence on the issue, but maybe the best thing without us debating it here, it is about mens rea, is to hear from the NPA. Will it assist them or not? And I think that's the key. They gave us a lengthy document that sets out the legal basis of why they wanted the or suspicion, and it relates to the FICA Act, and it relates to a case in terms of the FICA Act where the term ought reasonable to have known or suspected was dealt with by the SCA and accepted in that context. So, Chair, let's hear from the NPA, because I hear what Mr. Jeffrey says as well, but we need to hear from them whether they think it's necessary, but they did give us a document where they set out why they wanted it in. Thank you, Chair.
All right, I'm going to hear Mr. Jeffrey, and then once he's done, Mr. Mokgatle, please assist us.
Look, I know Mr. Mokgatle is coming in, but my I don't feel that the NPA are the correct people to consult on this, because the NPA want to make convictions as easy as possible. So if they could ask us to reduce the quantum of proof in a trafficking case from beyond reasonable doubt to balance of probabilities, that would assist them, but that wouldn't be constitutional. I would rather that we consulted a criminal law academic, because they are there at least, because what my concern, my angle of concern is the constitutionality in terms of the Bill of Rights. But look, I don't know how much further we can take it now. I don't think we can resolve it. Maybe we can separately go and speak to criminal law academics. But as I said, my problem with the NPA is they've got a vested interest in making things as easy as possible for them, which vested interest may be start fitting on rights in the Bill of Rights. But let's stand it down, and I don't think we can resolve it now.
No, I'm going to ask Mr. Mokgatle to address this.
Thank you, Chair. I must really say I wholeheartedly align myself to this research that was submitted. You know, why we have it seems or appears to be an extended or overkill by the NPA, and it's not. You have to look firstly at the offence itself. Is trafficking that easy to detect? This is a clandestine offense we're talking about. When we have a word like diligence in that explanation dealing with ought to have known, a diligent person must be able to suspect, because we're talking here of an objective test of a reasonable man in the position of the trafficker himself or the person who benefited from trafficking. And then the court always decides, you know, this Bernard and Fulf would not give the prosecution undue powers. The prosecution still has to prove its case beyond reasonable doubt. It's just the burden of proof where you deal with issues of circumstantial evidence, for example, if you don't have direct evidence before the court. And it is my submission that a suspicion of it should be left where it exists in the bill and should not be removed, because by removing it you basically raising the burden of proof now to one of knowledge. And what happens where the for practical purpose if the evidence is presented that the complainant or the victim presented in a certain manner, and then the accused, who's a trafficker, failed to realize, or the beneficiary of the services of a victim of trafficking failed because, first, he was not diligent. A reasonable person in his position should have suspected that this person I'm dealing with has been trafficked. So basically, that test, the prosecutor will allege, but the court would come with an assessment and decide if the state has managed to prove its case. That's what I'm saying. It's not really giving us more ammunition. It's putting the traffickers to the test, that you cannot just say, I did not have knowledge. Like Honorable Swart have said, if it appears in the FICA legislation, it cannot be said to be, you know, an overkill. That is my submission. And if it's on the issue of constitutionality, every new act should be allowed. I mean, jurisprudence will be developed through cases. So if the defense were to raise the unconstitutionality of this term of suspicion, then the prosecution will fight it when it comes before court. And I think we should leave it as it is. And it will assist also in the development of our jurisprudence. Thank you.
All right, honourable members, I think I want you to consider the suggestion made by Mr. Jeffrey, that we leave it there. Otherwise, we'll go in circles, all right? We've heard your views, and we acknowledge that. And perhaps follow the route he suggests, whereby we find someone that we can refer this matter to, and give us, it doesn't have to be one person, there can be more than one, and look at the views, and then take it from there.
That, Chair, we've got state law advisors here that certify the bill has been constitutional.
Sure, sure.
Thank you, Chair.
Sure.
Remember the bill that they certified did not have suspected.
No, but they
are
now.
All right, well, you can ask them to go away and look at it too.
It's not only the constitutionality, it's whether it means something, and it doesn't mean anything because they're saying ought reasonably to have known or suspected in the same clause with the same requirements. So if we want to have suspected, you must then define suspected as something different.
All right. Ms. Williams and the rest of your team, Mr. Bassett, Stierman, can we ask you to have a put a spotlight on this particular aspect, and come back to us with your considered opinions? We'd really appreciate that. Okay. Mrs. Stein, you got some more hand grenades waiting for us to set off?
On page 12, footnote 9, we...
Is that fine, honourable members? That's done. Okay. Next, Mrs. Stein.
On page 15, footnote 10.
14. All right. Please hold, Mrs. Stein. 14.
No footnote. It's the shape of footnote.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I was having a look at this definition again. It concerned me again.
Which
we?
Which one?
Subsection 2.
Subsection 2.
A person who particularly concludes a forced marriage with another person. We've now removed the definition of forced marriage. We've removed forced marriage out of the definition of exploitation in the definitions. And when you read this section now, it's basically saying any person who concludes a forced marriage with another person for the purpose of exploitation of that child. My concern is now, I mean, I thought we'd agreed that this forced marriage of any kind would be wrong. In terms of this bill.
Child or, with a child or person.
Yeah, anyone where it's non-consensual. But my concern is that if it's only for the purpose of exploitation, that won't necessarily cover everything that we need to cover. Because exploitation is very specific. And is that, yeah, for, only for sexual exploitation, servitude, forced labor, child labor, removal of body parts, or impregnation. Now, what if it's not only for those purposes? What if it's just a forced marriage, full stop? Surely that's also wrong, if you bring someone here for the purpose of marrying somebody. It may be covered by sexual exploitation or servitude or forced labor, but I'm not sure that it would be. And I would like some more consideration given to that.
So if one looks at it, remember we've been included that under the offence of trafficking. And the offence of trafficking must be for purposes of exploitation. Okay. That's why exploitation is linked here. Unless one makes it a separate offence. Mm.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Yeah, I mean, my worry is the whole of the bill, as Ms. Steelman has said, is the requirement of... purpose of any form or manner of exploitation is a requirement of the main offence of trafficking. So we have then linked adoption and forced marriage to exploitation. And if we try and have them standing on their own, then it goes wider than we were intending. I mean, the issue of forced marriages, look, I think in most cases if there's a forced marriage, it would be for exploitation. Because remember, you know, I suppose you could have a forced marriage where you force a South African to marry a foreigner so that they can get residency rights. Now, is that also not, well, that wouldn't then be covered. Okay, but is that trafficking? Because remember, this is trafficking. So any forced marriage should be illegal. But this is a trafficking bill, and probably forced marriage is illegal, presumably in the Home Affairs legislation. I don't know.
It should be.
But this is for the purposes of this is for trafficking, not just for. So, yeah, basically, forcing a local to marry a foreigner so that the foreigner can get residency status or rights of residency or whatever is wrong. But is that trafficking? And I don't think it is. No, because I mean you're no. It,
not bringing it, it, here for that
no, no. The it's a local. Okay.
Well.
So you're not going to bring anyone here. You're not going to bring anyone in the country to get their residency rights. If you bring anyone into the country. Then it's going to be for purposes of exploitation. You legitimate them because they're then marrying a South African,
right?
So that you can exploit them.
So the South African is not being trafficked.
So what I'm saying is, in the case which does happen, of a forced marriage with the intention of giving the foreigner a local forced to marry a foreigner to give the foreigner residence. Rights of residency, that's illegal. Or should be illegal, but it's not trafficking.
Yeah,
no,
probably not, because the other person was brought in and it
yeah.
Benefit.
So I think it's fine as it is. I mean, the definition of forced marriage still stands, okay? Which is a marriage concluded without the consent of each of the parties. We took it out of the definition of exploitation because you can't if you had it in the exploitation then it would be slightly if you had it in the definition of exploitation then it would be slightly the section this 2.2 would be slightly nonsensical. Concludes a forced marriage which is exploitation because it's in the definition for the purposes of exploitation. So I think that's the reason we took it out. So I think that is correct, but I do think the exploitation, the purposes of exploitation requirement is necessary for trafficking.
This question whether exploitation is adequately covers all the grounds that we need to cover. Now, I mean, if you look at adoption as well, I mean, children can be trafficked only for the sole purpose of just being adopted. Now, are we saying here that they've got to be adopted for the purposes of exploitation? They might not be. They might just be people who want children.
In that case, it will be just an illegal adoption. But if you want to bring it under trafficking, it must be for purposes of exploitation.
Christine, you okay? I just want to go back to this question of the illegal foreigner being coming here and then a forced marriage taking place. Clause 4 in the bill sets out what trafficking actually means. Delivers, recruits, transports, transfers, harbors, sells. Well, is that a sale? Exchanges, leases, or receives another person within the border. All right, let's think about it. I guess it would be very hard for Mr. Mokgotle's people to prosecute a case like that as trafficking. It's just forced marriage.
Yeah, but it's a question of and where, you know, it forced marriages should be illegal. I don't know if the Home Affairs person can tell us. I don't know if it's maybe jumping something on her whether it is illegal or not. But one would imagine it should be as a illegal forced adoption, and illegal adoption would be illegal. So there should already be crimes, and if they're not, they should be. The question for us is, are they a trafficking?
I think it is.
And because trafficking requires exploitation. So if you run off to Lesotho and you illegally adopt a child because you don't have any children and it's taking too long in South Africa and it's much easier, things are, you go to Malawi like Madonna, although that seems to be a bit tighter now. But anyway, you go off somewhere because you want this child. That is not, but it's an illegal adoption, that's not trafficking. The trafficking requires exploitation. Similarly, you can't find a person to marry in South Africa. No one will marry you for a variety of reasons. So you basically then meet up with someone on the a Russian bride on the internet, and you say, I'll marry you so that you can come here. And the Russian bride says, great, I don't want to be in Russia, and I'll come. Is that trafficking? It may be an illegal marriage, but it's not a forced marriage because she's agreed.
Yes, but we're talking about a forced marriage.
Yeah. But then, okay, you go then to, because you really are so bad that even the Russian man or the brides won't marry you, you go to a more impoverished country to look for a bride, and you basically force, speak to a woman's family and say, look, you have to marry me. Or I'll pay you X amount if you get your daughter to marry me. And they say, fine. It's been forced. And you bring her here just because you want a wife. That's not trafficking. What would be trafficking, and I think what we do cover, is where you bring her here and then you subject her to slave labor.
Only then it becomes trafficking.
Then it's trafficking. It's a crime, but it's not trafficking. But it's a question of I think it's fundamentally widening things if you remove the requirement of exploitation and trafficking.
Yeah, I think the protocol itself is also very clear that it can't be trafficking if the intention is not exploitation.
How can I, coming here from India, wanting to be recognized as a permanent resident, and then having someone forced into marriage with me not be regarded as exploitation?
It will be covered under other legislation dealing with it. If it's a forced marriage, if the purpose was not exploitation, then your Home Affairs legislation will cover it.
Okay, this gentleman's point. I mean, we're following Palermo. Palermo is trafficking person means the recruitment, bloody, bloody, blah, for the purpose of exploitation. It's a Palermo requirement.
Mm-hmm.
Exploitation should include, at a minimum, the exploitation of the prostitution of others or the forms of sexual exploitation, forced labor or service to slavery or practices similar to slavery, servitude, or the removal of organs. So it is a Palermo international law requirement for trafficking. Let's not go wider.
if a forced marriage should be a crime, but if it's not for exploitation, it can't be seen as trafficking.
What would it be then for people who make a whole business of getting babies from wherever to bring for adoption to a particular country? Not for exploitation, just because people want babies, but they pay people a pittance compared to what they would otherwise.
Like adoption agencies.
Yeah. What would that be a crime under?
If they don't follow the legal procedure, then that can fall under illegal adoptions, which is covered in terms of the Children's Act.
Okay. All right, Mrs. Stain. Next hand grenade.
On page 15, footnote 10, it is just to indicate that the subclauses 3, 4, 5 and 6 are now dealt with in clause 11, dealing with the liability of persons for offences under this chapter, and not only trafficking. Clause 7, footnote 11, I think we have dealt with that.
Okay. Page 17
we have footnote 12 that also relates to a carrier who knows that a person or ought reasonably to have known that the person is a victim of trafficking. And then we have in sub 2 a carrier who on reasonable grounds suspects that any of the passengers is a victim must immediately report.
All right, well, we'll wait for the opinions and then we'll try and be consistent throughout. Okay.
But this wording actually may settle the other problem.
Will it? Okay. All right, Mrs. Stanley.
On page 18, footnote 13. These are the provisions that I've referred to earlier, which were found originally under the trafficking in persons offence. We have only included all the offences under that under the chapter 2 here.
Okay.
On page 20, this is the clause clause 13 dealing with the penalties. We are suggesting, I think in the document that was handed to you last time regarding the table of offences, the suggestion is made that we only keep an amount of a fine in A and B, mm-hmm. but that we do not provide for a specific amount in the other paragraphs.
Yes, that was our agreement, honourable members. Okay.
With regard to footnote 15, also in the document that was handed out to the committee, it was suggested that perhaps consideration should be given to prescribe a longer term in respect of the failure to report, and your decision is awaited.
Honourable members, your decision.
That was, Chair, I don't have the document in front of me, but there was a comparison that somebody did of other legislation, and it came up that that was lower than is the norm. And I thought the thing was then that let's follow the norm.
No. Chair, it's the Sexual Offences Act. While the reporting in the Sexual Offences Act only relates to children, and this bill relates to children and adults, in the Sexual Offences Act, duty to report carries a failure of duty to report carries a 5-year prison sentence. In the Children's Act, failure to report in some instance carries a 10-year, and we feel that this bill should be aligned somehow to other legislation and come up with, we would suggest, 5 years.
Okay, good.
Chair, there's 213.2, I don't know if you can raise that.
Yes.
This is this issue where regional courts can start dishing out life imprisonment. And I see the footnote is that we decided that. You know, I'm not comfortable.
That's isn't quite correct. I think it was open. It's something that we raised as a possibility for consideration by the committee. I just raised the question at the meeting, I think it was on the 8th or 9th, and it's something that the committee has to decide on. I just want to remind many members that regional courts can in any event impose life imprisonment, but that's only in respect of minimum sentences. Otherwise they are confined, they can give up to 15 years imprisonment or 300,000 rand fine. We are looking at increasing the fine because it was last increased a very long time ago.
I'm just not comfortable. I mean, we have these different divisions of the courts to ensure that harm isn't done. Also the levels of, I mean, I think it would be fair to say that the not fair to say. I mean, it's accepted that your more experienced prosecutors are, or your more skilled, your best prosecutors are at the level of the national in the high courts, what you call the state prosecutors, state advocates. Okay, whereas your district regional court prosecutors are not that skilled. I mean, they don't get paid as much. So I think from a point of view of the serious cases should be prosecuted in the High Court, I think it's not right to increase the jurisdiction of the regional court. If the regional court can deal with minimum sentences and impose life in terms of a minimum sentence, fine, but let's not go any wider.
Mr. Swart, followed by the Honourable Division.
I'm a bit confused now because 13.1A is a minimum sentence, therefore we don't even have to say it. Yeah. In terms of that, the regional court can impose a life sentence, and all those sentences are in any case automatic review goes to the High Court. So do we need sub 2 at all? Is it there purely for the purpose of the amount, the 100 million rand? Is that it? Not about so much the life imprisonment, but because the link with life imprisonment to the Adjustment of Fines Act is not in accordance. And that is why we are saying that the regional court has jurisdiction for that amount, which is in terms of the other legislation that we referred to when we took this, the FICA legislation, the other POCA legislation. So I don't have a major problem with the regional court having that jurisdiction. I think it already has it. The question is, do we need to say sub 2 at all, or do we just need to specify it for the amount, the fine amount? And maybe just to Honourable Jeffries, do you have a problem with, if you follow that, then it would pertain purely to the financial amount, not so much the life imprisonment, which is already part of the jurisdiction of the regional court.
First, the Honourable Debbie Schaefer, and then Mr. Jeffrey.
Chair, I don't recall us agreeing to that, first of all. Second of all, if we did, I agree that we shouldn't. But I don't see where we agree that the regional court can have that jurisdiction in one. I mean, we're saying we're only giving it to them in terms of two. So we're just saying what the sentences should be. We're not saying that the regional court can impose those sentences. I mean, the implication, to my understanding, is still that it's got to be done in the relevant court, unless we put in two. And if it is covered by minimum sentencing legislation, which it may well be, given that it's usually organised crime, which I think they are covered, then that would be fine. Otherwise, I would also support the idea that we don't, in this bill, extend the jurisdiction.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Yeah, I mean, 13.1A is the minimum sentences. That's the main charge of trafficking, and that's subject to minimum sentences.
and then if I'm understanding it correctly, that can be heard in the regional court in terms of 13.1a. 13.1, so that's covered, you don't need to say anything about it. 13.1b then is an extension, and I'm not happy with any extension. So really, I would feel rather that 2 falls away.
Does the regional court have extended jurisdiction? So why have we got a problem with the regional court having for trafficking, which is a very serious offence? If we've got, let's bring it in line with, we are in line with existing legislation elsewhere. I agree with Mr. Jeffries on 1A, but I don't understand the objection to 1B. And it relates to the high amounts, 100 million rand.
There is something in PERC, I just can't remember.
Let's look at it and come back to it. Yeah, Chair, I mean, we can look at it, but I would rather it be deleted and Mr. Swart can raise it if he wants. I mean, the fact that it may be in poker doesn't mean it's poker's about something else, and it doesn't mean that one would want to put it here. 4.2, remember, is the adoption and the forced marriage, which may become a little bit more, I mean, the issue basically is the appropriate court. And that may be a bit more of a debatable question, which the High Court should decide on if they want to, if there's going to be a penalty.
No, you're right. When you look at the offence, it's
not a big. I just can't remember why we needed the regional court jurisdiction. Well, it's unclear from the draft as where they got it from.
From us?
No,
they denied that. Oh. I think that I recall saying that is something that the committee would have to consider.
Okay.
Mr. Jeffries is not referring to these specific offences of adoption and forced marriages. Maybe it's not the main trafficking issue, so maybe we should delete it and if necessary. I don't know. What do you think?
I'm happy. Unless you were the one who wanted it to stay. I'm saying if regional courts are in under the main, they can deal with the main offence under minimum sentence legislation. And why extend it for anything else?
Sub 2 comes out?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, Mr. Bassett, Mrs. Stein. Okay, good enough.
On page 21, yeah, footnote 17, the committee on 9 November suggested provisions that an accredited organization who comes into contact with a person suspected of being a victim of trafficking should also report that victim to the police. And in view of that, we thought that it might be necessary also to include a similar provision relating to children.
Okay. Honourable members.
I think that's what Mr. Jeffrey raised, the different paths that you can get. And this, we're trying to include this path for identification of it.
All right.
On page 22, footnote 18, that is with regard to subclause 3b, a person referred to in subsection 1 must provide reasons for the knowledge who makes the report in good faith is not liable to civil or disciplinary action on the basis of report. And then what we inserted there is despite any law, policy or code of conduct prohibiting the disclosure of personal information.
Mm-hmm.
on page 23. This is with regard to clause 16. This is where we were asked to come up with two options with regard to the reporting. Containing a list of persons, and then the option under subclause 1A, more a open list.
Is firstly, honourable members, is that what we asked for? Okay. And then secondly, do you want to decide now which option to accept, or give yourself some time to think about it?
Yeah, I like the option. Because you've got the number, plus you've got four any other person, which leaves it relatively open to someone we haven't thought of, such as a teacher or something. I think the teacher was the example given. So, do we need to deliberate on it much? The option is, I think, Mr. Jeffrey's raised the issue today.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Now, what I find a bit odd with the option is that you specify three people, okay, and then you say anyone else. But the chances of, I mean, a social worker and a medical practitioner are more likely to come into contact, and I think should be specified far more than a traditional leader. There's nothing against traditional leader. I mean,
You see, the
issue that you've corrected is this. You made the extension on any other person bound by a law policy not to disclose. You've taken that out to make that a despite. And you've now got it as any other person who in the execution of his or her duties comes into contact with an adult person who's suspected of being a victim of trafficking. So I like that. I didn't like what you had before, because it seemed to be conditional on you had this restrictive code stopping you from reporting, and then you had to report. Now it's basically any other person who in the execution of his or her duties comes into contact. That's fine. My gripe with what you've got is why list those three? What you should, I would have thought, have done is list the people maybe in the first one. Either you have any person who comes into contact. You don't name anybody.
Yes.
Any person who comes into contact.
Yes.
Or you say an immigration officer, labour inspector, social worker, medical practitioner, blah blah blah, traditional leader, or any other person.
Yeah.
And then you've combined the two.
The long list?
Long list or any other person, because then you're highlighting in that these people are particularly.
Yeah. You're opening it up. So if you're a doctor and you come into contact with, I don't know why this is in brackets as though it's being taken out, but if you're a doctor and you come into contact with a traffic victim, the law says as a doctor specifically you have a duty to report. The open-ended thing of any other person who in the execution of his or her duties is a catch-all. So I think it's basically in support of Mr. Swart. Have the long list. I don't know why you bracketed from social worker to traditional healer.
I think we told them to take those out.
Okay. But have the long list and then include or any other person who in the execution comes into contact.
Okay, Mr. Bassett. Are we satisfied, honourable members? Good. Okay.
With regard to paragraph B, footnote 20, that is also to provide that an accredited organisation who comes into contact with an adult person who is suspected of being a victim, to report that person to a police official, and then we say we after the provisions of subsections 8 to 13 apply.
So, Chair, just as 16.1b and 15
one be the same.
It does look like it.
The same. So 15.1a and 16.1a must be the same. So in 15.1a you've just got despite the provisions and then also what's the difference? Is 15.1a more strenuous? That's the reporting of children. What's the difference between 15.1 and 16.1 now?
The one deals with the child and the other
with
an adult person.
The child, but is there any difference in the requirement?
15.1a only provides that any person who knows
that.
I
know that,
yeah.
But it used to be the long list.
Yes.
Okay. Obviously, the two should read the same.
They should.
But now, the duty on these people, is there any higher duty for children than there is for adults? Because then, Jay, if 15.1 and 16.1 are the same, then would it not be better, rather than repeating them, to have them in their own standalone clause, and then you deal with the rest of 15.2, which or the sections that are different, you then deal with in their own clause.
I'm missing you there.
Okay, 15.3. Yeah, 15 is about reporting
child
victims. Child victims. 16 is about reporting
adult
victims. My question is that in the beginning bit particularly, what is the difference? Why do we need separate provisions for children? Why do we need separate provisions for adults? One would imagine, I haven't gone through it, that the provisions for dealing with children are more onerous and tighter than for adults. But to prevent a simple repetition, should we not have a situation where you have a reporting and dealing, if they're, like, as I said, it looks to me like 15.1 and 16.1 are, in essence, the same. At the moment, you've got 15.1 is just a different wording, but from the discussion we've had on 16.1, the wording is actually better in your option on the 16.1. So where the sections are the same in those two clauses, deal with them under one section of reporting victims of trafficking, and then anything that's more onerous for children, put that in a separate section.
I get that, sorry. So just the reporting of children, I think there's a basic a difference. You start off with the reporting of children. Everybody, every single person in South Africa has a responsibility. Yeah, and the adults, you've got that nuanced difference, yeah.
Okay, sorry, I didn't realize how we changed it, yeah. So then that would mean that it gets kept separately, yeah. I withdraw that, yeah.
So we move on to page 24, Mrs. Stein.
Page 24, footnote 21. Unfortunately, there's a strike through which should not be there. It is only to indicate that subclause 2 should remain.
Okay.
Subclause 4 on page 24, footnote 22. We also include the word despite any law, policy or code of conduct in paragraph B relating to a person who report a victim of trafficking.
Okay.
On page 25, footnote 23, as the committee decided on 9 November that the recovery and reflection period should commence once a person is reported, this duty to inform the person, which was originally with the provincial head, must now shift to the police official, or maybe another official to inform the foreign person of this right to apply for a recovery and reflection period.
Okay.
Page 25, new subclause 8. Footnote 24. On 9 November, the committee said that we must look at the provision to provide that a police report should also form part of the assessment.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we agreed to. Chair, presumably they've dealt with the regulations for police report, and they've referred to the police report and the regulations.
Yeah. On page 26, footnote 25, this is where we have taken out the duty on the provincial head to inform the foreigner of his right to apply for a recovery and reflection period, because it will now be with the police official. On page 28, footnote 26, we provided in subclause 3 that if the appeal is unsuccessful or the affected person does not lodge an appeal, we originally had it, the accredited organization or the provincial department must deal with that person. The committee then asked us to look at a provision so that that person, if he's an illegal foreigner, must only be referred to Home Affairs for to be dealt with in terms of their legislation.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's in a sense it will apply anyway, but I think it's useful having the provision so that people can see, well, that's the end of the road as far as the trafficking legislation is for this unsuccessful illegal foreigner. The only change of that, as I raised earlier, Mr. Bassett, I think, noted it, that I don't really like the thing of in terms of existing immigration legislation, that's vague. I would have thought it would be a specific reference to the Immigration Act.
Yeah, the next provision, as we discussed yesterday, we went with the Home Affairs, and it was indicated by the committee that we should take out the stuff, sub-clauses 1, 2, and the options in respect of clause 3, and reinsert the old sub-clause 1, that's which true. We will do. The question Engel and I raised is whether that wouldn't be better placed, and we discussed it yesterday, and I can't remember, it would be better placed... Where was it? Because that would also help us with our drafting. Yes, possibly in clause 15, dealing with the reporting of a child. Yeah, at the end of clause 15.
Are we happy with that, honourable members?
Okay.
On page 29, footnote 33, provision of healthcare services. At one of the previous meetings, the committee decided or asked us to look at the provision so that we can refer to the section 27 of the Constitution. On page 30, it's clause 19. With regard to subclause 2 there, we inserted provisions that link the that the offence was committed as a direct result of the person's position as a victim of trafficking to the fact that the prosecution must then apply to the court for a postponement.
Mm.
With regard to footnote 35, it's a new subclause 3. We were asked to consider a provision that where the prosecutor suspects that the person, we have included some options, the charged in a criminal prosecution or involved in a criminal prosecution or giving evidence is a victim of trafficking, that prosecutor must refer that person to the provincial department. The offence in which this person who is suspected to be a victim might not necessarily be related or be as a direct result of his position as a victim of trafficking.
Okay, honourable members, you've read the full footnote. Mr. Jeffrey?
I raised points last time when we discussed this around, shouldn't the prosecutors have a discretion? I'm just trying to think, and it doesn't seem to have been captured, and it related to the requirement that they must apply to court for a postponement. I don't know from the NPA's side. So you've got this trial set up. You've got 16 accused. It's a high court trial. And you then on reasonable grounds suddenly start suspecting that accused number 16 is a victim of trafficking. Your case, it's complicated to sit down for a week in the High Court. Now, in terms of the Act, you must postpone. Must postpone. Now, you do want to protect the victim who... I think it was the offence was committed as a result of... Yeah, the point was raised that the offence was committed as a direct result of the person's position. I suppose you could still, in terms of this section, postpone the continuation of the case against accused number 16 and continue with 1 to 15. You can separate. Yeah. Okay, no, I see. I think it's then covered. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, I thought we were.
Can I just comment on that?
Yes.
I'm not sure we should be limiting it to people who are charged in criminal prosecution. What happens if they're giving evidence in a criminal prosecution and then it becomes apparent or they suspect that they are? I would be more comfortable saying involved in a criminal prosecution. Or giving evidence in a criminal prosecution.
Same issue?
Same issue.
Okay.
Covered under 15 and 16. The reason for this was some kind of protection for trafficked victims who are accused. So the duty to report is already covered, applies to the prosecutor as with anyone else. Because it's the person charged. Okay, no, you've got good giving evidence. Okay, but mine is look, the issue was to protect the trafficked accused. Okay? And it was to ensure that the case if they are accused number 16, that they're then not prosecuted if the case arose as a result of their being trafficked, not because of something else. Why must the issue of giving evidence be here? Because That duty, the duty will be on the prosecutor in terms of section 15 or 16, clause 15 or 16, to report it. What added protection is needed?
There we go. Yeah, we go for the first option then.
Yeah, Chair, the thing basically is, okay, I see from the footnote that this is something the committee were looking at, but I think on reflection, this section applies to the accused, who is a victim of trafficking. A witness who may appear to be a witness of trafficking doesn't need any protection from here. They're not being charged. And the reporting duty applies to the prosecutor in terms of section 15 if they're a child and 16 if they're an adult.
If they're giving evidence and then they ask questions which incriminate themselves, then they later become an accused but they've already given the evidence, do they have the same rights to keep to not answer?
Accused, then this would apply.
Yeah, but they won't be accused at the time they're giving evidence.
Same rights.
Just to make sure, must we then include a prosecutor in clause 16 as a person who must report? Is that what you're saying?
Look, they are covered by the any other person.
Mm.
If you want to put them down.
No, then you're going to. Oh, right.
But it's a problem of that list is.
It's going to grow and grow.
It's going to grow.
Like Pinocchio.
But you can put them, because they were they're dealt with elsewhere, you can put them specifically. And then the NPA are liable to a criminal offence if they don't report trafficked children.
I'm just a little bit confused here. With regard to the sub-clause 3, the one that suggested to be inserted, if one compared it to the previous one in sub-clause 2, the offence must specifically linked to the fact that a person is a victim of trafficking, but in subclause 3, that's not the requirement. So, and I'm not really sure how that's going to work.
Okay,
Chair, I think subclause 3 is not necessary because it's dealt covered under clause 15 and 16, the duty to report. So I think the whole of it can be deleted, and the issue of this clause is protection for accused.
Sub 3 comes out, yeah. Sub 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's protection for accused in trafficking cases. So if it's a person who's had up for assault murder, it might relate, they might have killed the syndicate. I'm just trying to think of an example, but they did something else that's not related to trafficking, then the case against them must continue because it's unrelated to the fact that they were a victim of trafficking allegedly. Because you don't want people arguing, no, I was a victim of trafficking, therefore this offence for speeding doesn't apply to me. But the duty, you want the duty on the prosecutor to report, yeah.
On page 31, footnote 36 applies to the status of foreign victims of trafficking, and I think we will deal with this once we have received the inputs from. The next footnote is on page 39. This is just to indicate that subclause 4 is clause 26 of the introduced bill. Mm-hmm. On page 40, clause 27, footnote 57, we have just indicated that a person has been issued with a letter of recognition. Is entitled to access a program offered by an accredited organization, so we've deleted the words or a person referred to in section 40.
Okay.
Chair.
Yes.
I just ask here, Paul, when we go back and clean up, this is possibly a good example. Can we take out that strike through because it is not part of the introduced bill, or do you still want to see it there for historic? Okay.
It's gone.
On page 41, sub 2, on the top there, it is footnote 58. It is just a new footnote intended to give effect to the committee's discussion on 6th of September that we should include an exit plan in the plan that must be drafted. With regard to footnote 59, I think we have dealt with this previously, that this whole clause was moved towards the clause 34, information management, footnote 60, we have already dealt with that.
Yes.
It is now found in clause 25.4. Regarding compensation on page 42, footnote 61, there we have inserted a referral to section 301A. So it now refers to 301A, 2, 3 and 4. And we have on page 43 deleted paragraph C because of the reference now to section 301A of the Criminal Procedure Act.
Okay, honourable members. Okay.
On page 44. Yeah, we've dealt with this. I think footnote 64 is a proposal by the NPA, and I think that as on one of the last meetings the committee decided that the compensation must be paid into the CARA, the Criminal Assets Recovery Account. So we have deleted in footnote 67, you will see that we have deleted the word state.
Okay. So, Chair, we could take out all these old footnotes as well.
Yes, please.
On page 46, footnote 69 indicates that this chapter was not discussed, but it has now been discussed.
Sorry, just 67, 68 would be helpful.
Yes.
Footnote 70 on page 46 was inserted as suggested by the committee. Footnote 71, we have deleted the provision of summary deportation. It was first moved to the recovery and reflection period, but it was taken out completely now.
Okay.
The variation of that one might find its way back into the bill as we discussed yesterday. I think Home Affairs said they would get back to us on that.
Jeffrey?
Yeah, well, we specifically wanted and they agreed to a provision preventing the summary deportation of those people being considered for the recovery and the reflection period or that it applied. The question would be, so the rest, there's no protection. The question would be, do we need to provide for a prohibition, and it was something we should have put to Home Affairs for children. And that would be, I think, what is the existing provision in terms of the Children's Act. It doesn't look like there's any such, there's no such provision, there's this requirement as far as I can see. So it's, if there's no such provision in the Children's Act, then let's not add it. I just was querying whether there was. I can't see it. Is this requirement of the DG checking on how things are back home, which is fine.
Okay.
On page 46 though, footnote 72, that is with regard to clause 31. The committee indicated that this duty of the Director General Social Development to repatriate a child must be performed either by the Department of Home Affairs or after consultation with the Department of Home Affairs. We consulted with the Department of Social Development, and they indicated that they prefer to perform this duty and that the role of the Department of Home Affairs should only be in respect of the issuing of documents. They will not have a role in the consideration of the factors as set out here, as these are functions of social development. So what we suggest is in one, to say the Director General of Social Development, and then dash, I may not repatriate a foreign child after without giving consideration to those factors, and then insert a paragraph B. Must, if he or she decides to repatriate a child after the consideration of those factors, request the Director General Home Affairs to, and I think what I said is to insert the word facilitate the issue of travel documents or other authorizations. There is an option also there that the Director General must consult.
Out.
Yeah,
that we've removed that. Already decided that should come out. Mr. Jeffrey.
Can the DG of Social Development repatriate anyone?
Does he have that authority in law?
I don't know the way to repatriate, but they have a whole unit called International Social Services that is responsible for returning children to their original countries. They return children who are in the country to their original countries.
Can the officials just check on the word repatriate as a power to DG Social Development? Because my fear would be that only the DG Home Affairs can repatriate. It was, remember, return, which is a much looser meaning. And you may then just need to look at the wording. I think the intention quite clearly is for Social Development to do this. I see the Children's Act is it's entitled Repatriation of a Child Who's a Victim of Trafficking. The Director General that Social Development may not return a child. The word return, although it was repatriation in the beginning, it was return in the text. I'm not sure the implication of that, but just one doesn't want to give the DG Social Development powers that he doesn't necessarily have. Maybe it should be return. Because it's a slightly different repatriate. My understanding is sending them back, and it may not be. It usually would be voluntary, but it may not be voluntary. But it's not deport, which has specific legal meanings. If you can't come back, you didn't intend to come here. We didn't want me to come here under these circumstances. But the word return in that section of the children may be more appropriate than repatriate.
Okay. Can you look at that? Good.
Those provisions that we discussed yesterday, and we were just to remind committee members, we're going to, at your request, insert provisions that link with Section 31(2)(b) of the Immigration Act, that exemption provision, in respect of A and B. So that's in respect of adults and children. Yes.
Okay.
on page 47,
mm-hmm.
footnote 74, we have taken out the words "or trafficked" again, as we were requested. And then footnote 75, the word "return" was replaced by the word "repatriation," mainly because return, we use "return" in the bill as being, it's used in the context of internal trafficking and repatriation as cross-border trafficking. On page 48, footnote 76, we have amended it just to give a clear explanation of the procedures to be followed to the victim of trafficking. clause 33, the heading there, footnote 77, we included the word "suspected" there. Footnote 78, the same thing, we are referring to a person who is suspected of being a victim of trafficking.
So yesterday they said that they would already be a victim by that point. If they're being repatriated, they would have been declared a victim already.
Yes, that is what I have said. But the problem with that is, I think one can't just assume that the other country would have declared them as a victim of trafficking. They might also have different procedures in terms of declaring them victims of trafficking. In terms of our bill, we have a specific process in terms of which they need to be assessed. And you don't know whether a similar process might have been followed by the country repatriating the victim. So one should be careful not to accept people coming to South Africa say you are a victim of trafficking and just to find out later that they might not be a victim of trafficking. So I think it's quite important that one, once they get to South Africa, to put them through the assessment process to determine whether or not they are victims of trafficking. Because if you're going to say, because you came back from another country, we see you as a victim of trafficking, that basically means that you're entitled to all the services provided for in terms of the bill. So I can't see why they can't go through the process as provided for in terms of this bill to ensure that they are indeed victims of trafficking before they become entitled to the services provided for.
Maybe I'm not following you, but I mean, we're going to repatriate somebody, either we're talking about other people who are trafficked away from South Africa and bring them back, or people who are here and are going back. People who are here are going back must already have been dealt with under
ARPA. Yes, that's correct, but what we're talking here is people coming back from another country to South Africa. Yes, they will get a benefit here. So the question is, are you not going to put them through the assessment process to make sure that they are indeed victims of trafficking, or are you going to say just because you have been repatriated from another country, you're already considered as a victim of trafficking? So my suggestion is that a word "suspected" should stay and should not be deleted.
All right, honourable members? Good. Okay.
I'm still with clause 33. Home Affairs suggested some changes with regard to 33 B,
yes,
which we will have a look at.
Good, all right.
On page 49, we originally provided for the word "notify," but that has now been. Changed to refer. That was the one footnote. Basically, those footnotes relate to the fact that a child or an adult person must be referred to a provincial the provincial Department of Social Development for an assessment. Th- that also relates to the footnotes in paragraph 6, Romans 6. Footnote 85, this was removed from clause 25 of the introduced bill. This is now the new place. Only in footnote 86 we have referred to trafficking to an area, but some places we are referring to a place. So the committee must just decide on whether a place or an area.
Place is more specific. I think it's appropriate to place.
Place.
And that should be consistent throughout?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Good.
I also
take some codes and then stick off and then further.
In paragraph B on page 49, there's not a footnote, it's just something that I've seen just now. The words were trafficked again must just be deleted there.
No. This is within the Republic.
Our concern with the trafficked again was people being able to claim they wanted to stay in the country because they were liable to be trafficked again. It's due consideration, so it's a different thing. It's going to be a less popular clause than for the foreigners. So I don't have so much of a problem with the trafficked again being in the internal traffickers because it's a consideration too. Doesn't mean that they can't be sent home even if they are, but it's a consideration to be given. And the fear with the trafficked again was for the people who would not be returned because they can say they'll be trafficked again and therefore they want rights to stay in the country.
Mm. On page 50, the footnote there again refers to the use of the word area or place. The committee on one of the other meetings asked that a provision be made for the accredited organization to facilitate the return of a victim trafficked within the RSA, and subsection 2 is in line with that committee's request. That is to take reasonable steps to find suitable family members, and then if the victim in question does not have the financial means to facilitate the return of the victim to the place. Footnote 89 is a suggestion by us to make it clear that clause 35 deals with both cross border and with internal trafficking.
Okay. Page 60.
Yeah. On page 60, clause 41, this is also something that the committee decided that we should revert back to the words after consultation with. And then footnote 91 on the same page refers to the areas in the Republic to and from which the victims are being trafficked.
In that case, it is
yeah, area.
Because places you want the person to be returned to their home place. Area is, there's a whole lot of trafficking going on in Lusiki City. What's going on there?
Yes.
So this stays as area. Okay.
On page 61, footnote 92, we still need a decision on whether we are using the word provided or on condition.
What's the difference? We usually have a proviso. Is it provided?
Yes.
I think provided that.
Yeah.
Okay.
On page 62, sub 3, it, the words in conjunction with
yes, that's fine.
And that's where
we... That's where we have completed
done a circle.
Oh, I was wondering why you were saying we were nearly finished. I wasn't aware. Well, well done, Mr. Bassett, Ms. Stein, Ms. Stierman, Madam, thank you very much. Right before we go rushing off, you were suggesting that Mr. J.B. Simonioni's ad hoc committee be allowed to meet next week. Both days. Yes. Mr. Jeffrey?
The suggestion that there's maybe this consultation whether he wants them.
Yeah.
I think there is a date that that committee has to report to the House. But if not, then look, I don't know if I don't think trafficking will be ready next week. PPI is not ready. We may need to have another subcommittee meeting because it was one area that just needed to be addressed. But otherwise, Chair, I'd suggest if the committee is available, if Mr. Sibagnoni is not using Monday or Tuesday, I mean Tuesday or Wednesday, that if we have anything, we look at Criminal Procedure Act.
He has to report, his ad hoc committee has to report by Thursday next week. So I can't see him not taking Tuesday, Wednesday. Okay, and then we'll have to find space for the subcommittee.
Well, look, we can look at that as a smaller group. But yeah, I wouldn't want to suggest that I think we are well placed and that we do have a further meeting. I mean, the week after next, that's not, I think we're still here.
Yeah.
That maybe we do, we're not here.
Huh? No, it's good.
Oh, you're here.
We go to Germany on the 26th. Oh, yes, we're not here.
No, the 26th is a Friday.
It's 27th.
So. Oh, okay, we go at the end. Okay, that's where we are.
Yeah.
But I would want to suggest that we do find some time, and this may be less popular. I mean, the week of the 5th of December.
Yeah.
Because it would be useful, even if we don't vote on the bill, that we basically have given them a clean bill.
Yes.
Which we can vote on at the beginning of the year. But I do think we should, we're not yet in that position. We need to see the Home Affairs stuff. And it would be useful if we've largely cleaned it up, but that...
There's outstanding matters. Yeah. All right. So you do have some time now, Mr. Bassett, between now and our next meeting.
We're moving offices next week, so...
Oh, goodness. Which building? Who's got the lease? No, I didn't ask if you're responsible. All I asked is, who's got the lease? Thank you, we're adjourned.
We're going to finish it here from the Department of Justice.